And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to talk with our friend, attorney Erwin Aronson, about the NLRB stuff going on today, and also a little bit about the history of workers' compensation. You know, as we talked about last night, as union density has dropped, as union democracy has dropped, the radical right and their billionaire investors have really gone after all those things that the generations of yesteryear fought, bled, and died for, to make sure that we had protections, not only in the job, but also in our regular lives. And they're really going after that. Workers' comp being one of that. So I want to go back and look a little bit at the intent. What was the original intention, and what did we have before? And I think that's worth looking at. A lot of the things that the Republicans are attacking right now, understand why they're in place, the NLRB being one of them. So it'll be interesting talking to our good friend Erwin about that. Also, Connie Kelleher, she's going to be here, spokesperson for IAM Local 751. The machinists evidently have come to an agreement with Boeing over a contract. Now, I was watching some of the debate today on C-SPAN, and George Miller said that they had come to an agreement with Boeing on South Carolina. I can find that nowhere to be the case. So she'll be the person to talk about that. Also, Mark Price, labor economist with the Keystone Research Center, is going to be here talking about the privatization of the liquor stores as the hearings have started today. 2 days of hearings down in Philadelphia as Representative Turdzai is pushing his agenda to privatize. And also in the third hour, Jerome Wilson, underemployed worker, going to be here talking about the day of action next week on December 5th as folks, about 100 people from Pittsburgh, head to Washington, D.C. For the Take Back the Capitol events that will be happening all next week, and we'll be following that as it happens. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So I don't know that our news covered too much. As I was flipping through the news channels, didn't see an awful lot about what's going on across the pond, but you had some 2 million public sector workers, federal workers there in the UK heading out into the streets. Why? Well, they're stealing their pensions, man. They're raising the retirement age from 60 up to 68. They want them to pay, 50% more for their pensions, all the while not asking the very well-to-do. I mean, much like we're doing here, they're following the exact kind of austerity measures that we're trying here. But there you get 2 million people in the streets. Here, our federal workers, one, they can't. It's illegal. They couldn't have a general strike thanks to the laws, thanks to Taft-Hartley. But beyond that, those people, they get it. We're talking about cutting Social Security here. I don't see the greedy geezers out in the streets like I would hope that they would be to protect that, for future generations. Across the pond, we see it quite often. But there are folks out in the streets, and last night, the police in both Los Angeles and Philadelphia thought it was time to clear the streets. And they sent in their cops with riot gear and their garbage trucks, and they kicked all these people out of their encampments, swept up all of their stuff, arresting a bunch. Friend of the show, he was arrested for putting up a tent in the middle of the street. Here's the thing, when I look at what's going on around the country, and I see almost no reason for places like Los Angeles and Philadelphia to do this, because all they're really doing is really strengthening people's resolve. And I think drawing more attention to it. I'm in favor of people in the streets. I'm in favor of direct action. I'm in favor of what's going on. But you look at a city like Los Angeles. You look at a city like Philadelphia, Democratic mayors. I think I got a problem with that. Because you look at what's going on in New York, and you understand Bloomberg. You understand Bloomberg because Bloomberg has a very authoritarian mentality. In fact, he was given a speech at MIT, and he was asked why he preferred City Hall over the White House. And he said, I have my own army in the NYPD. Seventh biggest army in the world, according to Bloomberg. He said, I have my own State Department. Much to Foggy Bottom's annoyance, we have the United Nations in New York, and so we have the entree into the diplomatic world that Washington doesn't have. I think that's kind of arrogant on his part. I've got the seventh largest military. I've got the army there. And he's not afraid to use it. And as we see these attacks going on, I often go back to the Jay Gould. You pay half the working class to kill the other half. Those cops in the riot gear, they're you and me. They're part of the 99%. They're the one. They've gotten screwed as well. Their pensions have been gone after. They're the ones whose jobs are on the line. And it's always kind of fascinated me that they're willing to follow those kind of orders when there's no public safety violations here. There's no violence going on. And if there were, all in favor of it. You go and you gotta keep law and order. But these are peaceful demonstrations. These are people who are simply gathering in a park and in a public place. And, I would reach out to my friends in the police department and say, at some point, you're one of us. Your pensions are being stolen. Your jobs are on the auction block. And you look what the Republicans have done the last 10 months. It's been going after just those kind of people, the public sector workers, hundreds of thousands of jobs axed because they do not believe in what is public. And you look at what went on today. We spent an entire day paying the House of Representatives to debate a bill that doesn't stand a snowball's chance in hell of ever passing. It's not going to pass. It's never going to become law. Never. But they spent an entire day in this mental masturbation. It was just an exercise in futility. But what it was is very, very clear in their positions. It wasn't about passing the law. It was about passing the message. The message to the funders, the message to the billionaire class, the message to the big corporations that we're your guys. We're going to deny those workers their rights. So they spent a good point, most of the day debating this thing called, and you gotta love it, it's a beautiful name, I love the name, Democracy and Workforce Fairness Act. The Democracy and Workforce Fairness Act. Who could be against that? Who could be against the Democracy and Workforce Fairness Act? Surely not I. But you get into what they're talking about. They want to draw out the length of time it takes for workers to be able to vote. Remember back when we were talking about the Employee Free Choice Act? They were so concerned about your right to vote and, oh, you should have the right to vote, the secret ballot. Oh, they were just all a Twitter. And now what they want to do is they don't want you to vote for a very long time. And you look at what some of these people were saying. I spent the day watching it. It was probably a waste of time, but I spent the day watching Republican after Republican, the vast majority of them from Tennessee or Alabama or Virginia, all the southern states, all the right-to-work states. But there they were lining up. Phil Poe, Republican from Tennessee, he was saying, my state's got such a high unemployment rate. Unions would just kill jobs. I'm going, Tennessee? What's the union density rate in Tennessee? Is it really that high? And the answer is no. And it really wouldn't hurt them at all, but it's part of the framing. And the question I had is, if they have such a high unemployment rate, it's a right-to-work state. Shouldn't, according to their frame, shouldn't the jobs just be flowing there? And what would speeding up elections do in a right-to-work state if you don't have to join? I'm kind of confused. Martha Rowe, Alabama. She thinks we should just tear down all the labor laws. That's how you create jobs. You tear down all those regulations. Because after all, regulations, as the guy from Virginia said, unions and regulations in the NLRB, well, those kill jobs. And that was the frame the whole time. And the message being workers' rights are burdensome regulations. So your right is a burdensome regulation. And while the act is never going to pass, and we're pretty clear about that, what it was that messaging. And I loved our boy Todd Platts. Todd seems to believe that employers don't have enough time you know, to talk to their employees. They don't have enough time to convince their employees with rational discussion and talk that they don't need something that they signed up for. To Todd, I would say the employer has from the day that they hired you to treat you right, to pay you well, to make sure that your family's okay, to make sure that you don't want to go anywhere else. You know, every person that I've ever met who has decided that they were going to sign an authorization card and become someone who was going to want to vote for a union, every one of those people worked for an employer who treated them poorly. It was very, in my recollection, it was never about wages. It was always about conditions. It was always about respect. It was always about having a voice in safety. If you take that away, which is what the Republicans really are working to do, and they spent the whole day pushing their message that, you know, unions are bad and all this stuff is bad. And I've always said, you know, if unions are that bad, why would anybody want to be part of them? Oh, that's right. Safety, wages, conditions, hours, respect, a voice where they spend the vast majority of their waking time. And like we talked about last night, at the end of the day, once you cross over that threshold into the workplace, if you don't have a contract, if you don't have a representative, you have no rights. You can't even leave if you want to. The boss says you can't leave, you can't leave. So I would suggest people talk to their representatives. Again, another whole day spent wasted arguing something that I think really a problem that they want to create is going to make the situation worse. And that's worrisome. So when you ask the question, why have Democrats and union members seem to be on the same page? You know, why has labor moved to the Democratic side? Not that that's their safe haven. Just look at what happened today. Look at the voices that stood up and said, well, you know what? We want to take that right to a speedy election away. I mean, I got a right to a speedy trial, don't I? Yep. Just amazing stuff to me. Anyway, so later on in the program, I guess we found her. The welfare queen has been found. She has been found and convicted. We're going to talk about her a little bit later on in the program. We're going to take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. When we come back, our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson. Stick around. Right back after this.
Smith Show.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Tonight we turn back the clock to what we were talking about this time last year. We'll be back live and in the studio on Monday. Enjoy your Thanksgiving holiday.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Max Richmond of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare says both programs are highly popular and very successful, and there's no economic reason to cut them. Richmond was part of a group of labor leaders and progressives who met with President Obama recently to talk about the so-called fiscal cliff looming in January. Richmond came away from that meeting believing that President Obama will protect Social Security and Medicare.
The president, after I spoke about Social Security and Medicare, he claimed that the people were with him, and he believes, I think, he has a mandate to protect beneficiaries in any way he can. And I'm hoping and I believe that he will follow through on those campaign commitments.
Richmond says a post-election poll by Lake Research Partners shows voters strongly opposed to cuts in Social Security and Medicare. That includes opposition to raising the retirement age. Majorities also support raising the income cap on the Social Security tax as a means of strengthening Social Security. Richmond says Social Security is a strong, successful program as reflected by the annual trustees report.
They announced that this program would be able to pay everybody every penny they're entitled to until the year 2034.
Walmart workers at stores around the country are poised to walk off their jobs on Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving. Workers are pushing for changes in working conditions and a real voice on the job at the nation's largest retailer. Walmart has filed an unfair labor practice charge against the UFCW union, accusing the union of violating labor law in its Walmart campaign. Hobby Lobby plans to appeal a ruling saying the company isn't exempt from the Obama administration's contraception mandate. Jesse Russell reports.
Hobby Lobby has been denied an exemption to providing employees with emergency contraception through their group health plan. The company is run by the family of David Green, who argued in the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Oklahoma that the rule violated their Christian beliefs. Judge Joe Heaton said the rule did no such thing, as Hobby Lobby is a secular, for-profit enterprise and does not possess the same religious rights as an individual. The Green family considers emergency contraception, such as the day-after pill, as an abortion drug. Hobby Lobby must comply with the new rule by January 1, 2013. If it doesn't, it could face a fine of nearly $1.3 million per day. Hobby Lobby had been providing emergency contraception until the mandate garnered significant media attention. The company said it didn't realize it was included in the health plan, so it stopped offering the contraception. Hobby Lobby is one of more than 40 companies challenging the mandate.
This newscast made possible in part through underwriting support from the IBEW. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Listen, I spent all day today watching C-SPAN, watching the Republicans do their dog and pony show. And, you know, I kept hearing big union bosses. This is the origin of the Obama administration just paying off the big union bosses. And I'm going, you know, really? We're paying you an entire day's salary to sit here and basically just put on a show. This legislation has absolutely no chance of passing. And they know that. But what it is, like I said earlier, it's about sending that message to big business that we're on your side. It's about sending that message to their big funders that we're your guys. Now you look across the pond, 2 million people out in the streets, 2 million public sector workers saying, no, you're not going to steal my pension. No, you're not going to raise my retirement age unless we negotiate for it. See, the Republicans, they don't want to negotiate. They want to impose. Anyway, I've got our good friend Erwin Aronson on the line. Erwin, thanks for taking time for me.
Good to be here. How are you, Rick?
I'm frustrated. You know, I look at what went on today in the House. My tax dollars spent an entire day of the Republicans wasting time, stalling, delaying, running out the clock, and not creating jobs.
Well, you know, I have a different take on it than you for a change, I think. I watched a lot of that today, too, because when I read the real news, when I read the AFL-CIO news, when I read the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO news, when I read my own local union's newspaper, I hear about us getting kicked around, beaten up, losing ground, about people losing their jobs, about assaults on unemployment and workers' compensation, assaults on collective bargaining rights, and just devastation of pensions, both in the public and private sector, and I feel pretty low. So I turn on CNN, C-SPAN today and listen to this garbage, and I find out that we're the most potent force on the face of the planet, that we are so strong and so powerful that everybody kowtows to us. And even though I know it's a lie, I smile about it because I find strength in the articulations and descriptions of who we are or how we are perceived. And it's really quite wonderful. It's kind of like the old story about the Israeli gentleman who quits listening to Israel Channel 1 and starts listening to Al Jazeera, because once he listens to Al Jazeera, he finds out exactly how powerful the Jewish state is. So I hear you loud and clear, And I agree with you wholeheartedly that what we observe today is an exercise in taxpayer-funded political rhetoric by a lunatic fringe of the right wing trying to exploit the reality of a Supreme Court decision called Citizens United by saying all of the things they think their business patrons want to hear so that they can get even more munificence and more cash flowing downstream toward them from big businesses that are exploiting workers and exploiting the American political system all at the same time.
You know, and you look at this, and you know, I've had a lot of people say, well, why do union members, why do unions tend to support Democrats? And I wish every union member and I wish every person who works for a living would have seen what went on today. As the only people standing up for a worker's right to organize seem to be the Democrats. And I think it was pretty clear that while not, they're not their outward champions most of the time, they've still, for the most part, have our back.
Well, more significantly, it's not that working people support Democrats. It's working people and members of unions who tend to be the backbone of working people in this country support our friends and oppose all others, regardless of political affiliation. That was the exhortation made to us by Samuel Gompers 120 years ago, and that is the reality today. It so happens that it's easy to tell the players, and you don't need a scorecard to tell them these days because of what things like what we saw on C-SPAN earlier today with this frothing at the mouth, foaming, lunatic, right-wing fringe that thinks it's good politics and good public policy for the United States to beat up workers and to kick their democratically elected and selected representatives around and excoriate them to a degree never before seen in American history. If they had had television and C-SPAN in 1843, we would have seen no worse than we saw today.
Yeah, good point. You know, I saw Congressman Rob Andrews. He brought up the fact that, you know, the Republicans seem to be protecting the CEO class, the very wealthy, because they're not allowing this small surtax to pay for the payroll tax break that they've given to the middle class. And Republican Representative Klein from Minnesota said, you know, he was angered by high salaries. And, you know, I kept thinking, you know, isn't this exactly why you need unions? So that when one of these CEOs gets out of hand and says, you know what, I deserve $20 million or $50 or $75 or $100 million, that you have a countervailing force that says, well, if you're worth that, so are the people who made it.
Well, beyond that, if the good congressman was so offended, so troubled, so outraged by out-of-control CEO salaries, he could sponsor a piece of legislation that would provide for a maximum wage in the United States of America. We have one for a minimum wage. Why not have one for a maximum wage? That's not unheard of in Europe. That's not unheard of in developed economies throughout the world. But I don't hear him doing something about what he says. It's easy to talk the talk. The time has come to walk the walk.
Yeah, I like what Congressman Todd Platt said. You know, it's one of these things that just kind of...
A good Pennsylvania.
Yeah, you got to scratch your head over this. He said, you know, he supported and sponsored this this euphemistically named Democracy and Workplace Fairness Act because, you know, he didn't think that employers had enough time to talk to employees. And, you know, I'm sitting here scratching my head. They go, well, didn't they hire them? Didn't they train them? Aren't they with them 8 hours a day, 40 hours a week? Isn't that plenty of time, year after year after year, to talk to them and treat them right? Isn't that when you talk to them?
Well, it gets even better than that. You know, if you read the National Labor Relations Act, the statute that our National Labor Relations Board is interpreting and rulemaking on as we speak tonight, that statute doesn't have a section, a paragraph, a sentence, a phrase, a word, or even so much as a syllable that confers any rights on employers. 100% of that statute that these people are complaining about confers rights on workers to choose democratically whether or not they want to be represented by a labor organization of their choice. All of the employer rights that people like Representative Platt are pushing and advocating and pursuing are not rights that are in the law. They're rights that were created out of whole cloth by judges and by anti-worker incarnations of the National Labor Relations Board over 70 years, over seven decades. But shockingly, all of those so-called employer rights are on top of everything you describe and are not provided for in the law and are stolen, literally, by employers every day and every way in every organizing campaign that has ever taken place in any community in this country for the last 50-plus years since the 1947 passage of the so-called Taft-Hartley Act, which, again, still spoke only to the rights of workers, not to the rights of employers.
So let me ask you a last question on this before we move on to something to the next topic I wanted to talk about. You know, there's all this talk about defunding the NLRB, and there was talk today of the Republican on the board resigning so that nothing could happen. What do you think would happen if the board didn't exist? I mean, if you had two people on it, there's part of me that says maybe we need to have direct action. Maybe we need to go back to what, or do what they're doing in Britain today, taking to the streets.
Well, you know, for a long time I have suggested to clients with greater and greater frequency that the processes and procedures of the National Labor Relations Board in general are not worker-friendly, even though this board was created by the law that is the bastion of worker rights. The reality is that the board's processes and procedures, until now at least, have developed into a panoply of things that defeat or undermine the right of workers to freely choose who and if they are represented by a collective bargaining agent. And this same board, of course, does very little in the way of protecting workers even when they are organized and employers commit unfair labor practices, and the labor board regularly defers cases of unfair labor practice charges to the grievance and arbitration procedure. So I've thought for some time that there is a problem with that. I mean, the problem with the question as you pose it is what happens when we have a situation where the law continues to exist, but the board is neutered by having less than a quorum of its statutory membership in place. And that creates the worst of both worlds for working people, because on the one hand, the board is incapable of acting. And on the other hand, the law that is utilized by employers to thwart the right of workers would still be in place. So it creates a terrible, terrible situation, one in which people like Congressman Platt ought to be saying that if the board has been neutered by a lack of membership, that its processes and procedures are immediately suspended unless and until such time as the board has a full, at least a quorum-based complement.
Right.
And then, of course, we do engage in direct action, and we engage, as they do in Britain and in any other, a number of other countries, in alternative processes and procedures. Intriguingly, if you go to Canada, look at Ontario, for example, the Ontario Provincial Labor Statute is a virtually verbatim copy of the 1935 Wagner Act, also known as the National Labor Relations Act, yet its interpretation of precisely the same words in precisely the same language is dramatically different. And people in Canada and in Ontario don't have to wait 6 months or a year or longer to exercise their right to vote. And people don't get fired with impunity for exercising their right to participate in union organizing drives. And people are not hounded or pursued or brought up on specious charges when they pursue their right to form and organize and join a union. And it's under exactly the same statutory language that we have in place in the United States.
And they have a much higher rate of density as well. And in talking about density, I had a listener send me an article written a couple of years back, and they're talking about the decline of union density and what was going to happen as density declined and workers lost the sense of democracy in the workplace. And it goes through going after things like unemployment insurance, like things like workers' compensation, prevailing wage laws, all of the things that through the years workers have fought for, that this person was predicting, and, you know, probably wasn't a leap, but predicting that in the coming years, you're going to see them attacking things, especially workmen's compensation. And I wanted to, you know, talk a little bit about it because I don't think most people really understand what workers' compensation was at the beginning. And so I'm hoping you might be able to talk for a minute or two about the origin.
Well, I can, sure. The origin of workers' compensation here in Pennsylvania, and that was pretty much contemporaneous with the development of workers' compensation systems throughout the then United States. The first workers' compensation law was actually adopted in Wisconsin, the same first state to adopt the public employee bargaining law many years later. But in Pennsylvania, in 1913, our state constitution was amended to permit a workers' compensation law to pass. Until that time, when somebody got hurt in their effort to earn a living, they had only the right to sue their employer in a classic negligence case, almost like an automobile accident case of today.
Right.
And they would have to have demonstrated that their employer was negligent or intentionally hurt them in order to get compensation. And the employers had a right to defend themselves through all the normal negligence kinds of defenses, including such things as the concept of assumption of the risk. They would come in and say that that worker who got hurt, you know, in the foundry or in the mill or in the mine had assumed the risk by accepting the job. Imagine that. And another wonderful one called contributory negligence, where a worker was subjected to an absolute defense by an employer because the worker was deemed to have contributed to the negligence that caused his accident or injury or disease as a result of going into the mine or the mill or the foundry or the factory. And the third defense that was available at that time was something called the fellow servant doctrine. It said, in effect, that you got hurt because of the conduct of a co-worker working next to you on the line or adjacent to you in the mine or nearby you in the mill. And even with those defenses and the classic negligence problems inherent in that litigation, workers were breaking through. Workers who were being killed and crippled and maimed in the workplaces of this state were breaking through and getting awards, significant awards. And the workers' compensation constitutional amendment to the state constitution and the law that followed that, now known as the Workers' Compensation Act, but in 1913, initially described as the Workmen's Compensation Law, was an effort to not protect workers, but protect employers from the unpredictability of judgments and lawsuits that arose when people were being exploited at work and being hurt as a result. So workers' compensation law says in Pennsylvania that it's basically a no-fault law where if you get hurt or become ill or are injured in a situation that arises out of your employment, you will be entitled to limited compensation, 66 2/3% of your wage loss, up to a maximum of the statewide average wage, and compensation for your work-related medical bill. And in return, workers had statutorily taken away from them their right to sue their employers. And that's been the state of the law since 1913. There have been modifications from time to time, increasing the maximum amount of compensation, changing how one qualifies for workers' compensation, the standards, and in recent years, shrinking and eliminating and cutting back those standards and taking away benefits and restricting eligibility, and now we face legislation that would do even more so. So this no-fault law that has existed since 1913 that was intended to protect employers from unpredictability associated with classic lawsuits and in return have workers give up their right to sue and have less than full compensation, less than the compensation that everybody acknowledges they lost as a result of having their working lives interrupted through an accident or an injury or disease, has become almost a my fault law where lawyers weren't supposed to be involved in this because you didn't have to sue. Now lawyers are regularly involved in workers' comp cases. Where you used to be able to go and see your doctor when you got hurt, now they have this captive period where workers are compelled to see the company doctor for a protracted period of time. And the company doctor, of course, is beholden not to the medical treatment needed by the worker, but to the employer that refers cases to him or her. We have further restrictions that say that once somebody has been out of work for roughly 104 weeks, 2 years, as a result of a work-related accident or injury or disease, they have to demonstrate that more than 50% of their entire whole body impairment is work-related, or they'll be converted from a total disability under workers' compensation to a partial disability. And when that happens, their benefits are capped at a maximum of 500 weeks, regardless of how long they remain disabled. And all of those infringements have already happened, and we're now down to the bones. We're no longer in the flesh. And the General Assembly in Pennsylvania, of course, in response to all that is going on, in response to the reality that workplaces remain unsafe even after all of our technological progress, is suggesting that there should be more cutbacks, more restrictions on eligibility, more limitations on benefits. And all that does is tell employers that we're going to lower the price of keeping the workplace unsafe instead of raising the price of making it unsafe.
So what happens after, 604 weeks? What happens to the injured worker then?
Well, it's only after 500 weeks, not 604. The 500 weeks is a part of the 104 weeks, not in addition to it. And what happens is after the expiration of 500 weeks, when someone is deemed to be partially disabled instead of totally disabled, their benefits, their wage loss benefits, are eliminated completely. Not partially, not somewhat, but immediately and totally, even though the system acknowledges that person remains residually disabled to some degree as a result of a workplace accident, injury, or disease.
What would make someone, according to state law, more than 50% disabled here?
It's impossible to reach. Okay, you know, because if one is totally disabled and has, for example, a long-standing work-related back injury, and develops over that 500-week or roughly 10-year period a heart condition, well then, obviously, the disability is based upon the dual conditions, not one, and the heart condition wasn't work-related. So it basically converts everybody.
So it's intended to kick people off of it.
It's intended to kick people off, exactly. Listen, they're proposing a provision now that would attribute to people a phantom job associated with fictional income who are on workers' compensation, and in so doing, convert them not only from total disability to partial disability and trigger that 500-week cap, but also deduct from their weekly benefits the amount of money that hypothetically would be earned by a job that can't be identified, cannot be identified, but allegedly is available somewhere in the economy within the limitations or restrictions of their medical work-related condition.
So hold on. So what you're telling me is if a worker gets injured, the employer can say there's a job out there doing this. Not that you're going to get that job, but it's out there somewhere. We might know it's there, and it generally pays $10 an hour. You're saying that they can take $400 a week away from you?
That would be what they would be attempting to do. That's what's in a legislative proposal right now in the General Assembly, even as we speak. That's the phantom job, and that's the fictional income.
Wow.
I mean, I guess the right to sue has already been constitutionally taken away, so it's not an either-or proposition.
Yeah, I would guess this compromise has been broken.
This compromise was broken a long time ago. This was the great social compromise of the 20th century. And everything that has happened to workers' compensation since with the exception of the 1972 amendments to the workers' compensation law here in Pennsylvania, has all been aimed at striking away, driving away, the balance in that great social compromise.
So how do we, how do you change these things? How do we go, is it possible to go back, or are we, this is where we are?
Oh, it's possible to go back. I am now old enough to have lived through the experience in 1972 when we amended the law in a positive way. And after we rolled up our sleeves, worked very hard in election, elected a General Assembly that was sensitive to workers' needs, elected a governor that was sensitive to workers' needs, Milton Schaap, we put through the legislature, after a series of compromises, a number of very positive changes in the Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Act that put occupational diseases under the aegis of workers' compensation, that created an automatic escalator in benefits, that eliminated waiting weeks, that made workers' compensation cases uniformly decided by a workers' compensation appeals board instead of being appealed to local county courts, so that exactly the same kind of case would get different treatment in Perry County than it did in McKean County, and different in McKean County than it did in Philadelphia County, and different in Philadelphia County than it did in Luzerne or Lackawanna County. So we made a lot of progress in 1972 as a result of working people effectively engaging in political campaigns that changed the character and changed the nature and changed the approach of the General Assembly, and elected not people who were pro-union, but people who were committed to justice and decency and fairness and dignity on the part of the working people who pay taxes and work hard in Pennsylvania, and those who want to. So the answer to your question is we engage. We engage in the public policy debate. We engage in questioning our elected representatives. We engage in political action, and we engage most profoundly in exercising our right to vote. And in so doing, we take control of our government away from the multi-rich and put it in the hands of the multitudes. It's a simple formula.
And that's why we see people all around the country out in the streets, and I'm hoping there will be more as the days, months towards the election come nearer. Irwin, it's always great talking with you, always educational and informative. I appreciate it. I hope to have you back again real soon.
Well, I'm hoping to be on again in this normal slot on Wednesday and next week. And in the meantime, if something comes up, I'm always as close as the next email or the next phone call for the Rick Smith Show and for all of its listeners.
I appreciate it. Irwin, thank you so much.
Thank you. Take
Let's take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of the Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com. The sky is falling. The end times are upon us. It's all over for America. And it's all because of you. You, the execrable voters. This is the wretched wail of a few corporate chieftains who claim to be somewhere between flummoxed and furious that Barack Obama is back in the White House. With his diabolical Obamacare and tax-the-rich attacks on us wealthy job creators, they moan, this president is out to destroy American business. There's a tsunami coming, cried one, so we must save ourselves. How do these trembling titans of free enterprise intend to do that? By firing employees, thus sending a message to workers that voting for Democrats is bad for their health. Elections have consequences, exclaimed a Las Vegas boss after offing 22 workers the day after Obama was reelected. Echoing this self-serving political ethic, a Georgia executive told C-SPAN that his fear of Obamacare made him fire enough workers to exempt his business from providing health care. I tried to make sure that the people I had to lay off voted for Obama, he noted, spewing spite. Then there's Papa John's, the billion-dollar-a-year fast food chain. John Schnatter, the present papa of Papa John's, had warned this summer that he'd jack up the consumer price of the chain's pizza if Obama won, because he was not going to eat the cost of assuring health coverage for employees. Post-election, however, Schnatter has decided not to slap his customers, but to slap Papa John's workers instead, by cutting their hours to part-time so he doesn't have to pay for their coverage. That's what you do, Schnatter snapped. You pass on costs. This is Jim Hightower saying, that's what you do, and what an exemplary way for the millionaire boss to boost productivity, loyalty, and morale of those who do the actual work that make customers want to buy Papa John's pizza, or not.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
That's what we're trying to do. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Something to believe in. You know, it's a good question. Why do so many lose and so few win? You look at the job numbers that have come out, and you look at the number of planned layoffs that have been going on. They've dropped for the second consecutive month here in November. But the number of jobs cut in 2011 has already surpassed that of 2010, as federal, state, and local governments continue to shed jobs, according to the CNN Money Report. Jobs cut this year totaled, I mean, this is just mind-blowing, 564,297 job cuts this year. 13% increase over last year, which is just under 530,000 jobs. The public sector, over 180,000 jobs shed this year. So again, I guess you could look to the Republicans and say, you know what? Congratulations, mission accomplished. You've wanted to fire cops and teachers and firemen, and you want to fire all those people who serve the public. 180,000 of them gone. Again, and you wonder why our economy is struggling to get by, Jake. You wonder why we're struggling to get out of the hole that we're in.
And isn't it amazing in the states where the conservatives have taken over? Not only have their policies failed, but they turned down federal money. In the case of Ohio and in the case of Wisconsin, they turned down money for a huge, huge federal infrastructure project. And the money went elsewhere. I mean, he has been, of all the states, Wisconsin has been an absolute disaster, and I do believe he'll be recalled. I do believe that.
Well, I don't think there's any question that that's going to happen. The question is how much money gets pushed in there, how expensive is it going to be. A new poll out, new Pew Research Center poll found that the T-Twizzlers, the support, not there. Last year, they, 27% of the people surveyed said, yeah, we agree with, with the position of the T-Twits. 22% disagreed. Well, that's kind of gone the other way. Now 27% are saying, no, they've gone way off the deep end. Only 20% agree. And again, I think you're going to, as we move closer and closer to the election, you see these Tea Party congressional representatives dig in. I think you're going to see that number even get worse. Interesting revelation out of Ohio. John Kasich claims he doesn't read newspapers. And if you don't read the newspaper, how do you know what people are thinking? How do you know what's going on? And it just tells me that they're just out of touch. Don't really care what people are thinking. Don't really care about what's going on. It's my ideology, my narrow-minded self-interest. That's the way we're going to go. And if you remember when he took office, and we had talked about this when we were in Ohio, the idea of him coming out and saying, well, we're going to do what we want. You don't like it. We're going to run you over with the bus. Either you're on the bus with us or we're going to run you over. Well, look what's going on over there. And look what's going on in Wisconsin, where Walker, 300,000 signatures in 12 days. 300,000. And you gotta love the Republicans out there going, well, it's false momentum. False momentum. 300,000 people signed a petition in 12 days. One person every 3.5 seconds. Well, he's come out now and said, well, I welcome. I guess you gotta do this. You've gotta throw out some bravado and say, I welcome the recall election. And I'm sure he does not, which is why he's got that crazy lieutenant governor out there saying, oh, your signature is worth more than 25,666 Bart Starr signatures. Hey, I didn't make it up. And, the reality is you can't make this stuff up. It's what they do. It's their mentality. I mean, you look at Michigan. The governor that they've got there and the Republican legislature they've got there. They have a quote-unquote welfare reform policy. They want to do the whole drug testing thing. They want to do really a whole bunch of really nasty stuff. Lifetime limits, I guess, 48 months down from the 60 months of what was passed a couple years ago. So they're making it harder. They're making it more difficult. I love the drug testing angle. That's one of my favorites. And what they did down in Florida is another one that just grabs me. It worked out real well down in Florida, didn't it? They tested those welfare people, and they found a whopping 2% of the folks who failed the drug test. Yeah, worked out really, really well. But here again, they keep pushing that frame of the welfare queen. Oh, well, she's out there. We just got to find her. Well, here in Pennsylvania, we have found the welfare queen. Yes, we have. Her name is Rochelle Ruby, 22-year-old woman from Lewistown, Pennsylvania, Mifflin County. She took $500 in supplemental nutrition assistance money. She took $500, and we prosecuted her for it. So now the welfare queen has been caught. That $500. How dare she steal $500 from the state? This is according to a press release by the Inspector General's office. They caught 9 Pennsylvania residents in the month of October and prosecuted them. 9. I got to ask the question, and it's one of those things that just kind of stuck with me for a second. 9 people. They caught 9 people in the month. 9. That covers low-income heating assistance, the LIHEAP money. That covers the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, the SNAP money. That covers the welfare payments. That covers a whole host of programs that help people. And you got to ask the question, WIC money, women, infant, and children money, how many people in the state, and I'm trying to find the number, and I'm still looking, but how many people in the state, about 12 million in the state of Pennsylvania?
About.
How many people in this state are getting some sort of help when they're saying one in four people are on food stamps across the nation? Maybe one in five? Out of 12 million people, if it's one in four, you're talking about 3 million people in the month of October. 3 million people collected some type of help. We caught 9. So it's telling me is the system's working very well.
We've caught the cheaters. Going to make them pay. But the program works. I wish, and this is where I kind of wish that we would go after the bankers and the CEOs with such vigor, with such hatred and such vitriol, and go after those people who have collapsed our economy, who have caused this crisis, and perp walk them. Where are the press releases there? How many of those people are in press releases? People over with their pension money. How many of those people are in press releases? $500, Jake. $500. Now, I'm not an advocate of stealing, but I got to be honest. At some point, I'm looking at $500 that the welfare queen here, evidently, you know, since we've now caught her, she's been convicted, no longer the queen, she's been caught. $500. How much do you think those Wall Street criminals stole in a minute? I guarantee it's a hell of a lot more than $500.
I guess we should be ashamed, and we thought it was a myth, and here we have proof.
Yeah, yeah. Well, see, here's the thing. I've always known there are people who game the system. I grew up in a housing project, and the reality is some people do try and game the system. I remember I remember like it was yesterday, the people in our row, because all the houses were, you know, kind of put together, four units put together. We were on the end, the people next to us, and the people on the other end were friends. And when the welfare inspector would come out, their kids would run out the back door into the other house. So that you would see that they had six kids, and the other one would have six kids. And, you know, eventually they got caught. I mean, they did. I mean, they did it because, you know, they did want the extra money. But eventually they got caught because they always do. You know, you and I, when we do something, we always get caught, and we always pay a massive fine for it. You know, do you know how much the woman, along with paying restitution, do you know how much the welfare queen had ended up with? She got court costs. She got fines. She had to pay full restitution and 12 months probation for $500. You know, I'm looking at these. You look at Vince Fumo. What did he get? 4 years? I mean, they're going back after that now. But yeah, we got 4 years, 55 months or something like that after all the stuff he did. And you look at these criminals on Wall Street. They're not even on trial yet. But I remember, you know, I remember them going and doing some of that shenanigans, and they always got caught. And I'm in favor of people getting caught, especially the bankers. I wish we would have that kind of energy, that kind of commitment, that kind of resource to go after them.
And I guess my question again, and I asked this before, where's the Obama's administration Justice Department? Where are they? Are you telling me? It is very, very difficult to believe that they can't go after people and nail them. With all the resources they have, I guess it comes down to will, doesn't it?
They priorities. Are they are them. I mean, they're all in. I mean,
I understand that.
You got that swinging door, man.
I'm shocked. Know, conflict of interest.
But here again, and you know, I look at this, and I want to talk about this later, because, you know, I wish that they would take the time to really go and spend some time convicting the real criminals. And there's this story that I'm going to talk about later. 5,000 members of the military may have had their homes illegally foreclosed on. And it only came up because, you know, some reporter and a couple of people, you know, reported it. 5,000 active military gone. Where are the bankers going to jail for that? Why don't we perp walk them? Where's the press release with the convictions there? Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You are listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Tonight we turn back the clock to what we were talking about this time last year. We'll be back live and in the studio on Monday. Enjoy your Thanksgiving holiday.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Max Richmond of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare says both programs are highly popular and very successful, and there's no economic reason to cut them. Richmond was part of a group of labor leaders and progressives who met with President Obama recently to talk about the so-called fiscal cliff looming in January. Richmond came away from that meeting believing that President Obama will protect Social Security and Medicare.
The president, after I spoke about Social Security and Medicare, he claimed that the people were with him, and he believes, I think, he has a mandate to protect beneficiaries in any way he can, and hoping, and I believe, that he will follow through on those campaign commitments.
Richmond says a post-election poll by Lake Research Partners shows voters strongly opposed to cuts in Social Security and Medicare. That includes opposition to raising the retirement age. Majorities also support raising the income cap on the Social Security tax as a means of strengthening Social Security. Richmond says Social Security is a strong, successful program as reflected by the annual trustees report.
They announced this program would be able to pay everybody every penny they're entitled to until the year 2034.
Walmart workers at stores around the country are poised to walk off their jobs on Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving. Workers are pushing for changes in working conditions and a real voice on the job at the nation's largest retailer. Walmart has filed an unfair labor practice charge against the UFCW union, accusing the union of violating labor law in its Walmart campaign. Hobby Lobby plans to appeal a ruling saying the company isn't exempt from the Obama administration's contraception mandate. Jesse Russell reports.
Hobby Lobby has been denied an exemption to providing employees with emergency contraception through their group health plan. The company is run by the family of David Green, who argued in the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Oklahoma that the rule violated their Christian beliefs. Judge Joe Heaton said the rule did no such thing, as Hobby Lobby is a secular, for-profit enterprise and does not possess the same religious rights as an individual. The Green family considers emergency contraception, such as the day-after pill, as an abortion drug. Hobby Lobby must comply with the new rule by January 1, 2013. If it doesn't, it could face a fine of nearly $1.3 million per day. Hobby Lobby had been providing emergency contraception until the mandate garnered significant media attention. The company said it didn't realize it was included in the health plan, so it stopped offering the contraception. Hobby Lobby is one of more than 40 companies challenging the mandate.
This newscast made possible in part through underwriting support from the IBEW. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Question, comment, something on your mind, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Well, it is the 12th anniversary of the battle in Seattle. As you saw, union members and activists from across the country converge on Seattle when the World Trade Organization had their meeting there. Basically, they shut down the meeting, which I thought was a great thing. But here we are, 12th anniversary. Also today, and kind of ironically, a 12th anniversary of that, it looks like the folks at Boeing and the Machinist Union have come to an agreement, a contract, and it looks like maybe the situation with South Carolina has been or will be solved. Let's ask Connie Kelleher, spokesperson for the International, the Machinist Union, Local 751. Connie, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you.
So an agreement today, correct?
Correct.
What does that mean? What does that mean for your members?
Well, the proposed contract extension, most importantly, it would secure thousands of jobs while it raises machinist pay and pensions. And hopefully it signals the start of a new relationship that will both meet our members' expectations for good jobs while giving Boeing the stability and protection it needs to be successful as well. So it's huge news for us, and it means a strong aerospace future for the Puget Sound region here.
So I guess the big question being, how does this play with what's going on in South Carolina? I mean, I'm sure you saw today the Republicans had their dog and pony show in Congress, and basically the front and center was what's going on with Boeing and the NLRB and the attacks on workers' rights. So this agreement, will this have anything to kind of rectify that situation?
If the members ratify the agreement, because they're always the drivers in all of this, and ultimately they decide, then we would consider the legal matter at the NLRB resolved, and from there we would take the steps for resolution with the NLRB, because actually it's their case that they're bringing forward on our behalf. So it could potentially settle that if members vote to ratify a week from today on December 7th, but you know, the most important news is securing jobs for the future here, that we see if we had not secured the 737 MAX for here, it would have been devastating for Puget Sound. It would have meant that we would continue building airplanes just through the current backlog and that they would continue to search elsewhere for future airplane models. Yeah, so we believe that this is a vote for jobs in our state.
Yeah, I can't imagine that Boeing would be dumb enough to try and go somewhere else, because you've got where the knowledge center is. I mean, the brain power, the know-how, the skills are there in that area, which is why it was always confusing to me why they sought South Carolina to build another plant when the knowledge center is on the complete opposite end of the country.
Exactly. You know, the workers should be their greatest asset and the thing they should embrace. I think the way this came about, they did sort of acknowledge that it started building when we won the tanker contract, and the Machinist Union members and the Machinist Union played a huge role in that. Our members were critical to delivering the 787 and fixing the problems from their failed outsourcing strategy, and we also helped them deliver the 747-8, another new airplane, as well as doing incredible things with the 737. They're now producing 35 airplanes a month on that line.
Wow.
When there's only 20 work days a month, and they changed the build process while they ramped up rates and never missed a delivery.
That's incredible. I remember seeing a story here recently where the workers actually pulled the plane out onto the tarmac there for one of the, I think it was a Japanese airline that they were delivering the big plane to, and it was one of those moments where you go, that's really incredible to see the workers actually pull the plane that they produced out on the line and hand deliver it to the customer.
Right, and truly nobody but the experienced Machinist Union members in Renton could do that, and we believe that this proposed agreement, not only good for our members, but it's good for the company, it's good for the airline customers, it's good for the communities, and it gives our members more confidence that Boeing's truly committed to Puget Sound, and it rewards the members for the work they've done to make Boeing, you know, a world-leading manufacturing company by providing them with the highest pay and best benefits in the industry. It has some pretty significant things in the proposal. There's a 2% general wage increase each of the 4 years, along with cost of living. And we not only preserved the defined benefit pension plan for current employees, but future hires, and got a bump in it each of the 4 years.
Wow, that sounds great.
And we still have the 401k with the company match at a time when more and more companies are cutting that out completely.
Well, I think I'm moving out to your area. Wow.
Yeah, and we preserve the retiree medical, which is a bridge if you retire prior to Medicare, not only for current employees but for future employees, which is something that's been a contentious issue in at least the last three contracts.
Right.
So it didn't come without some gain on our side. There will be more sharing in health care costs, but at the end of the day, we still have health care benefits that are far superior to those earned by other workers in the industry and around the nation. So it's something our members should feel proud about.
Absolutely. Good for your members. Now let me ask you, I guess the big question that I had is, you know, how is all this going to work with what's going on in South Carolina? Where does that leave that plant?
Well, you know, as Boeing has recognized that our members in Everett, you know, they've really rebuilt that entire program from the ground up after the outsourcing strategy failed. So we're confident that with the language we secured, our members will continue to be the primary supplier of the 787, but our understanding is that Boeing will plan to continue production of the 787s in South Carolina. Landing the 737 MAX for this region was huge, and like I said, we believe our members will still continue to be the primary supplier of the 787s as well.
Well, that's good news, because, you know, as I've understood, and maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, but there's plenty of work that Boeing has moved overseas that could easily, you know, go into that plant in South Carolina as well.
Oh, absolutely. They have outsourced enough work that they could fill that factory and all the factories probably in between from South Carolina to Seattle 100 times over.
So, you know, and getting back to, you know, the big argument that the Republicans were trying to make is that, you know, the issue with South Carolina, I don't think anybody has a problem with people building plants in South Carolina. I think the problem was that it was retribution.
Absolutely. It wasn't about where they went. It was about what they did to the workforce here of telling them it was retaliation. And I have to tell you, it was refreshing going into this round of talks, which they approached us. We didn't know where it would go. But it was certainly worth exploring with the decision on the new airplane hanging in the balance to hear what they had to say. And we really hope this is the start of a new relationship where we can work more closely together so that we're all successful. Our members have a lot of pride in the company and want to see Boeing successful, and really they are the reason Boeing is successful.
Absolutely. No, I spent today watching the NLRB. I watched the Republicans and the Democrats in the House argue about this workplace fairness and democracy thing, or whatever euphemistic name they were giving to drawing out elections. And, you know, Boeing in South Carolina kept coming up, and it was always this conversation on butting heads, being adversarial. And it's great to hear that, you know, what you just said, that here, this is a new beginning of working together and, you know, making the company successful, not just for the company, but for you guys, who sounded like you got a great contract.
I certainly hope so. But, you know, ultimately it is up to the members to judge on their merits. Should they reject it, the contract that we currently have remains in effect till next September, and we'll go back to the bargaining table next summer. So, you know, we're very democratic. It's always up to the members. And, you know, on the NLRB case, the thing that the Republicans seem to forget, they keep throwing it out like it's a new law. It's a 76-year-old law. This isn't something new. But what Boeing did was different. They were very public and very repeated in their message. And the message they've put out today certainly changes the tone a lot as well. And we heard that in all our meetings and all our dialogue. So we're very hopeful.
Yeah, I'm hopeful as well. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Connie Kelleher, spokesperson for the Machinist Union Local 751 out in Washington State. It's been nice talking to you. You sound very nice. You don't sound like the union thug, the union boss, the big union guy that I kept hearing being described today on the floor of the House. Where are these? And you kept talking about democracy and those members having the right to vote. I didn't get that sense today that's what's going on. So it's interesting to hear your side of it.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm not new to the union. I've been here 30 years, so a long time. And actually, ironically, it was my aunt and my grandmother who also worked at Boeing as machinist union members. So
two more union thugs, I'm sure.
Nope. Two more people that took a lot of pride in building airplanes for a company.
Let me ask you, because the frame right now, and I'm being facetious and saying, you know, union thugs and calling you a union boss,
right.
So don't take it the wrong way.
Oh, no.
But, you know, the frame is out there. And the right keeps pushing this, that if you're a union member, you're a union thug, and that these, you know, the people who are democratically elected to run the unions and to represent those members, that they're big union bosses who have only their own interests in mind. And everything you've told me about what's going on with Boeing out in Washington, none of that plays to the frame that I'm hearing throughout all of the media, throughout all of the discussion in Washington. Am I missing something?
No, but the union isn't an organization. The union is the members. I mean, it's very democratic. You've got it right that, you know, the message that mainstream media has carried is infuriating as a union member when you know that it's just your voice against corporate America. It's the only weapon you have. And the right to strike is not something that anybody does easily. I mean, you think long and hard when you're voting to give up your paycheck.
Been there, done that.
Yeah.
And I don't wish it on anyone, but you know, hey, it's the last resort. And sometimes it's used to jumpstart the discussion and get people back to the table, and it's a useful tool, hopefully rarely used, but it's a right that I think we must have.
Absolutely.
Connie Kelleher, I appreciate the time. Congratulations on the victory there, and I wish the best for your members and everybody out there.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Connie Kelleher, spokesperson for the Machinist Union, Local 751 out in Washington State. I'm going to take a quick break. Back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Rick Smith.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Tonight we turn back the clock to what we were talking about this time last year. We'll be back live and in the studio on Monday. Enjoy your Thanksgiving holiday.
Are you feeling that back to school squeeze? Backpacks, clothes, shoes, all the things they have to have because last year's stuff is so last year. If you have a supply shortage, we can help. We know what it's like, and we've got the ultimate hall pass for you. Transfer your high interest and department store balances to PSECU. Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate, good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit psecu.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
The sky is falling. The end times are upon us. It's all over for America, and it's all because of you. You, the execrable voters. This is the wretched wail of a few corporate chieftains who claim to be somewhere between flummoxed and furious that Barack Obama is back in the White House. With his diabolical Obamacare and tax-the-rich attacks on us wealthy job creators, they moan, this president is out to destroy American business. There's a tsunami coming, cried one, so we must save ourselves. How do these trembling titans of free enterprise intend to do that? By firing employees, thus sending a message to workers that voting for Democrats is bad for their health. Elections have consequences, exclaimed a Las Vegas boss after offing 22 workers the day after Obama was reelected. Echoing this self-serving political ethic, a Georgia executive told C-SPAN that his fear of Obamacare made him fire enough workers to exempt his business from providing health care. I tried to make sure that the people I had to lay off voted for Obama, he noted, spewing spite. Then there's Papa John's, the billion-dollar-a-year fast food chain. John Schnatter, the present papa of Papa John's, had warned this summer that he'd jack up the consumer price of the chain's pizza if Obama won, because he was not going to eat the cost of assuring health coverage for employees. Post-election, however, Schnatter has decided not to slap his customers, but to slap Papa John's workers instead by cutting their hours to part-time so he doesn't have to pay for their coverage. That's what you do, Schnatter snapped. You pass on costs. This is Jim Hightower saying, that's what you do, and what an exemplary way for the millionaire boss to boost productivity, loyalty, and morale of those who do the actual work that make customers want to buy Papa John's pizza, or not.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download our podcast there from the website, or if you've got a smartphone, you can download the Stitcher app and take the program on the go. So again, today the Republicans in New Hampshire, again, the assaults never seem to stop. The Republicans up in New Hampshire thought they had it, man. They thought they had the Democrats on their heels. They were doing their fundraising thing. They were out of town. They were doing Christmas shopping. It was, you know, it was Wacky Wednesday. Hey, let's like thieves in the night try and quick run a vote through to override the governor's veto and make New Hampshire a right-to-work state. Well, fell through. And good. Now, I said last night, this is one of those moments where if you're a Democratic legislator in New Hampshire, I think it's perfectly okay because this is such a backdoor move. This is such a, I mean, really just a scumbag move that the Democratic legislature should, they should meet them out in the parking lot and give them a good talking to. As my grandfather said, you know, sometimes you need to make a citizen out of somebody. A good backhand smack across the back of the head generally helps. Kind of puts them in the line, you know, makes a citizen out of them. I think the Republicans up in New Hampshire need to be made citizens, because this is really just a really scumbag move. At least that's my thought on it, Jake. I mean, I'm sure you've got more details into it.
Well, I think you're right. Unfortunately for the Republicans, the union leaders up there were ready for them. And according to the report I'm looking at, there were about 100 unionists up there scouring the halls and making sure that they had the votes. And, in fact, they were successful.
And how many jobs did they create? I mean, again, if you remember, go to November 2010. And all my Republican friends who went to the polls November 2010 voted for people who said, we're going to create jobs. How is this creating jobs? How is any of this stuff creating jobs? I mean, we're closing in the year on this, man. Where are the jobs? Where are the jobs bills? To me, all I'm seeing is the same old tired stuff that hasn't worked, that's failed in the past, but they're going to stay true to. Going to double down on tax breaks for the wealthy. Going to double down on deregulation. How's that? Where's that job creation? They kept laser focus. I remember it, man. The pledge. Laser focus. Amazing. And, you know, I look at this again, and I want to go back to this this story about these 5,000 soldiers who, you know, people like Bank of America and Wells Fargo and Citigroup, the claim is they may have improperly foreclosed on up to 5,000 active members' homes. And now the New York Attorney General is launching an investigation into it, because you got this recent report from the Treasury Department, who's saying, you know, 10 of these big banks may have gone in and kicked these soldiers' families out to the curb. And you go, really? Didn't you take that into consideration? Didn't you look into it before you made that call to kick these families, heroes, to the curb? Remember, these are supposed to be the people that we put up on a pedestal. These are our heroes that you've kicked their family to the curb, probably while some of them were deployed. I mean, it's deplorable. And I look at this story down in Atlanta, because now Mitt Romney, he wants us to start kicking people out of their homes forthright. If we have President Romney, the foreclosures will happen, and often. But you look what happened yesterday. Douche Bank from D-E-U-T-S-C-H-E, Douche Bank, in Atlanta, wanted to evict Vita Lee and her daughter. Vita Lee is 103 years old, her daughter 83 years old. In fact, the two of them didn't even know that they were going to be foreclosed upon. The sheriff's deputies pulled up, the moving people pulled up, and they looked at this 103-year-old woman in her house, and they go, no, we're not doing that. Just not happening. And what I find interesting is the bank, just all it is a, you know, hey, robo. I'm guessing it's all this robo stuff. It's all done by computer, and maybe that's what happened with the soldiers. Hey, it's just, you had the robo-signers, you had the robo-people, everything done, just the computer. Because the computer doesn't think about people. The computer don't care about people. It cares about numbers. Doesn't care about the people that we put up on a pedestal and call our heroes? No! 103-year-old woman. They wanted to boot to the curb. And I go back to, and you know, I've said it a number of times, Christian nation, family values. Yeah, that's
well,
our nation.
You know, good for those people who decided that no, enough is enough. But go back to the question of throwing out on the street people who are defending this country. Where are these Republicans? The party that loves the troops, and you said it right. How many of them take every opportunity when there's a speech to say they are 100% behind the Defense Department, 100% behind our troops? Why aren't they looking at legislation to prevent something like that? And more to the point, why aren't they looking at legislation that'll put some stiff teeth in the law and say, you do this illegally and you're going to jail? And I guess we all know the answer, don't we?
Yeah,
these banks have given large amounts of money to Congress.
And you look at, this judge just the other day said, that, you know, he wasn't going to let the SEC go through with Citigroup, because we needed finally to see what's going on. They got away with basically nothing, paying almost nothing. I mean, it was a lot of money in big numbers, but to them, drop in the bucket compared to what they brought in, I'm sure. Nobody went to jail. Nobody's homeless there, but, you know, these big banks, they got no problem kicking a 103-year-old woman and her 83-year-old daughter to the curb. No problem whatsoever. And would do it without blinking an eye. And that, you know, again.
And why isn't that national news? Why isn't that one of the big time
stories? Because we care about the Kardashians.
On ABC News and NBC News and CBS News. And then MSNBC, why isn't it front page news? It's emblematic of why you have hundreds of thousands of people out there in the street right now. The system is broke. And in many ways, it's immoral.
The Kardashians are having another baby. And the Kardashian had nude yoga instruction.
New baby?
I guess one of the Kardashians, and I guess there's a whole flock of them.
Oh, the youngest one?
I don't know. There's a whole bunch of them.
Yeah, she was pregnant.
There's a whole gaggle. You know, one's bathing nude with the yoga instructor or something. I don't know. And I don't really care. But to your point, I mean, the reason that you're not seeing this, because we're too fascinated with Moron 5 kissing some supermodel and, you know, the Kardashian baby and a fling and this. And we're worried about Gretzky's daughter sending racy pictures over Twitter. Because that's what's really important. You know, whether we can feed our families and whether we have an economy that works for all and, you know, whether people are getting kicked, 103-year-old women are being kicked to the curb, never mind. That's not important. Not important at all. So here's some good news. The very first lawsuit against Penn State coach Jerry Sandusky has been filed. Knew that was coming. According to John Doe A., he is alleging that Sandusky sexually abused him more than 100 times. He was a minor. And again, you know, I go back to this, and I haven't talked about it in a while, but, you know, from the ages of 10 to 14, I don't care who you are. And this is a parental thing. This is where I think you got to blame the parents to a certain degree. I am not letting my 10-year-old go with anyone from the center of the state to Philadelphia or to Dallas bowl game or to any of these bowl games around the country. I'm not letting them. I'm just not doing it. And I, you know, and look, if a grown man is bringing my 10-year-old gifts and traveling and giving special privileges and doing all of this stuff, my mind isn't wired to go, oh, he's such a nice man. My mind is wired to go, this ain't right. There's something wrong here. Just like with Michael Jackson. I mean, it was the same thing. Who in their right mind, I don't care who you are, I'm not letting my child come sleep over at your house without me there. Does that make any sense to you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And here's the bad thing about that Penn State thing, Rick. This guy is not one of the original eight. Apparently, we've been hearing about the eight. He's not even one of them. You are going to have lawsuits far into the future. Penn State is in for a long, tough ride. I got a report on the board of directors later You know, this thing is ever widening, and this is a real, real disaster.
I mean, you know, the Second Mile group came out and said, you know, hey, don't give us any more money. basically saying we're screwed.
I think they announced they're closing their doors.
Really. They're going to have to. Nobody's ever going to give them another dime.
And that points to what you said. Why wasn't there a red flag? That points to institutional neglect.
Yeah. Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with our good friend Mark Price from the Keystone Research Center. Evidently, they had a big hearing on the privatization of the wine and spirit shops. I can't wait to hear about what happened today. Right back after this.
Listening to the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Tonight we turn back the clock to what we were talking about this time last year. We'll be back live and in the studio on Monday. Enjoy your Thanksgiving holiday. Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Don't really care about the economy. Don't care much about democracy. I'm a member of the GOP, trying to form a plutocracy. But if I can just bamboozle you, and you share my narrow point of view, what a wonderful world this would be.
Oh, what a wonderful world it would be if we could just steal those workers' rights. Make sure we really want them to vote. Yes, we value the secret ballot. Oh, we so do. But we want to make sure that it's, you know, like 20 years in the future. We want to make sure that the employers have ample time to explain their position. I watched that thing on C-SPAN today. It was comical, but it was scary on a whole nother plane. Just puppets on strings. It was really, really kind of sad. Anyway, today began the two-day hearing in Philadelphia on how we're going to make buku dollars. The treasuries are going to be flush with cash. There'll be liquor stores. Well, there won't be. We're only going to have a few liquor stores, and the prices will be wonderful, and the profits will be great, and it'll be liquor paradise. If we only privatize the state wine and spirit shops, everybody will be happy. There'll be no negative effects. It'll just be just this wonderful paradise. Probably not, because you got Auditor General Jack Wagner, who's come out and said, really bad idea, guys. Bad deal for the state. Anyway, I got Mark Price on the line, labor economist with the Keystone Research Center. He's done some testimony on this. Mark, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, hey, Rick. It's a pleasure to be here. And, you know, excellent summary.
It would just be a wonderful paradise if we could just privatize those stores, if we could privatize that road that goes across the state, if we could privatize those places where you put your car when you go to work, if we could just privatize all that stuff, it would just be a wonderful world to live in.
Privatize your kids.
There you go. Do you think I'd get a good price?
Your kids, of course.
They are well behaved. Except for my wife. But this is the frame, man. It's going to be wonderful. We're going to make, it's going to heal our budget, and there'll be no ill effects from it.
Right. No, I mean, like I said at the outset, I mean, it's a great summary. It's sort of, you know, there is no trade-off. Is a big theme of the people who are really pushing this hard is, you know, there are no costs. It's possible to privatize and not have higher consumption and the greater social costs that go with that, and at the same time, it's possible to maintain a monopoly and just hand it over to the private sector and make the state a lot of money. It's really a bizarre sort of setup.
And you know, the people who are pushing it, you know, and again, you know, there are some folks who have no problem with just flat out lying. And I think about the Tea Party think tank over at the Commonwealth Foundation. I don't know how with a straight face you can say that by privatizing the wine and spirit shops, by making alcohol more accessible, making it an impulse item put right there on the shelf next to the Tic Tacs, that it may decrease traffic-related fatalities. I don't know how you make that argument with a straight face.
Well, you know, they in their defense, they put together some statistics and wheeled out their an econometrician from Duquesne University to make that argument. And, you know, we took a look at it, and basically they argue that states like Pennsylvania that heavily control the distribution and sale of alcohol actually have fatality rates, alcohol-related fatality rates involving cars, that are no different than states that have no controls. And we took a look at the data, and we noticed that a lot of other researchers had actually used, in addition to the variables they used, had used per capita miles traveled and per capita income. These are as important controls. And sort of you would probably understand better than anyone what it means per capita mile traveled. The more you drive, the greater the risk you're going to be involved in an accident.
Right.
And that's as true for alcohol-related accidents. And when we threw the per capita miles traveled into the statistical model and we threw per capita incomes into the statistical model, lo and behold, guess what happened? The results completely reversed from what the folks at the Commonwealth Foundation said was the case. We found that states like Pennsylvania that heavily regulate the sale and distribution of wine and spirits actually have lower fatality rates related to alcohol. So, yeah, it's one of those things, you know, you suspect that the researchers could say, well, we just didn't think of, you know, putting those variables in the model, even though, you know, the research, the data they got came from someone who actually used those same very models. So it's very strange.
Yeah, well, I would expect nothing less from our friends at the Tea Party think tank. But, you know, the thing that bothers me is, you know, there's all this money that we get from the sale of wine and spirits in this state that I would hate to give up. And no one's made a cogent argument to me that by selling this off, the long term, I get the short term fix. I get the addiction. I get it. Short term, we're going to get an infusion of cash. But what happens in 10, 15, 20 years?
No, absolutely right. It's, you know, you're basically, in order to get any money out of the system from private companies, you have to basically promise to give them a monopoly. And why would you turn over a monopoly to private interests so that they can make those monopoly profits? Why wouldn't you maintain that monopoly internally in public control? It's just a very bizarre process where on the one hand, you know, there is a desire to make sure that we continue to raise the revenue that we raise from the system. On the other hand, there's this push to privatize and basically eliminate any ability to sell and make that money back. So it's a very, very odd process.
As I understand, the number of stores that they're proposing is a massive increase over the number of stores that we currently have. I mean, look, I think there are three wine and spirit shops within very reasonable distance that I know of my house. When I need, you know, when I want something, I know to go get it. I know the hours. It's pretty convenient. It's got, you know, decent selection. I know where my stuff is. If I need my fix, I know where it is.
Right.
Why would I want, you know, one on every corner like you go to Washington, D.C., where every corner there's dry cleaning and liquor. Ooh, there's sandwiches and liquor. There's, you know, this and liquor. Why do I want that?
Well, actually, there was a remarkable moment today that your favorite friends at the Tea Party think tank basically made the argument that if Pennsylvania needs to have 10 times as many retail outlets, alcohol, wine, and spirits than it has right now.
10 times?
10 times. That if we followed patterns in the rest of the country, we would have 10 times as many outlets, which, you know, pretty much caught everybody in the room quite off guard.
And fatalities would go down.
Yes, indeed. That there's no, you know, again, it's all about selling the privatization, and that means, you know, telling a story that there are no trade-offs, right? It's not the case that you're going to see a rise in consumption, and therefore you're not going to see any of the social impacts, increases in DUIs and things like that. And, you know, again, looking at data from the Centers for Disease Control, it's clear that when you get privatization, you get higher social costs. And so there's this need to, you know, make it possible for us to get a free lunch, that it's possible to privatize and not have the negative side effects. And it's just not the case.
So let me think this through. A conservative world will be 10 times more liquor stores. So I can walk down the street and probably literally trip over one every block then.
You know, I would imagine every retail outlet should be a liquor store.
There you go. It would just be the add-on product.
Yeah.
You know, like the store next door will have a liquor cabinet. Nice.
You know, maybe we could install slot machines, a little liquor cabinet on the side.
You know, like they used to do with cigarettes. You know, when I was in high school, that's how all the kids got their cigarettes. They would go to the machine, they'd pull the little lever. You don't see much anymore, but we should do that with liquor. See, you've come on to something. Those kiosks kind of, you know, they were a little ahead of their time. You know, now maybe if you put them everywhere in the street corners, it would be great.
A kiosk for every family.
There you go. So let me ask you, in what was going on today with the big hearing there with Turd's Eye and the rest of the privatizers, what was the sentiment in the room? And then on that, you know, why haven't we been seeing a lot? I have not seen the Catholic Church or really the religious community come out against this as strongly as I thought they would.
Yeah, you know, the sentiment in the room, I mean, the room was probably most noticeably, as you'd expect, filled with folks from the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, 1776. You know, there were a few other individuals that were a contingent that looked almost like, you know, five or six people in really nice suits from the company, the PFM, the folks, the study for the Corbett administration. That study's going to be discussed tomorrow, but the suits were in the audience today. So, but you're right. The sentiment in the room was, you know, other than the unionized workers in the room, it was sort of mixed. It was, you know, a lot of retailers who were hoping to get this new alcohol business testifying. You know, the testimony and the questions from the legislators was pretty subdued. There wasn't a lot of aggressive back and forth. You know, most interested questions from the legislators was surrounding, you know, how do we do the privatization correctly? So at least there was a sense that they're trying to move forward rather than really seriously grapple with the issues of, you know, the competing issues of, you know, you're going to risk these higher social costs and how do you raise the money that the current system raises? So,
yeah, because for me, the way I look at this is they've decided. They have it in their bizarre ideology. It's in their head. You know, it's like the fat guy who's got McDonald's on his mind. He's not going to stop till he gets there. You know, they've got it in their head, and they're going to fit whatever fact, they're going to fit whatever little nugget in there to get to that end result. And at the end, I don't think it really matters whether we make a dime over it. It's just as long as they can wrestle it away from us.
Right. No, I mean, one of the questions I was asked today was, you know, a legislator was saying, well, if it is the case that states that privatize could potentially face these higher social costs, why don't people go back? Why don't, you know, constituents speak up and demand that people go back to a more regulated system? And, you know, I think one of the most important things for legislators is when they make a decision, they're, you know, the last thing they want to have to do is come back, revisit it, and reverse it.
But can you?
So, you know, the stakes are very high that, you know, if you're going to make a change, the change happens, it's basically done. And whatever the social cost, whatever the cost to taxpayers. So, you know, the stakes are pretty high.
But if you do make this decision, we say, okay, we're going to do it. And they go and they hock off all of these licenses and they take in a couple of bucks and all of the other, you know, the Walmarts and the Wegmans and all the Giants and all the supermarkets and all the chains, they get their license and they put it on the shelf, you know, just right next to the Tic Tacs. Is it possible to undo that and take those back and buy those back and not end up costing 10 times as much as what you got out of it?
No, yeah. I mean, it's hard to imagine that happening. So I think you're right. It's, you know, you hope that folks recognize this is a very important decision that shouldn't be made quickly. That's not always clear.
Have you seen any studies on where the state, you know, I'm some polling on where the state, the population is thinking on this?
You know, that was a topic today. And you know, I think the population in general, you know, given the nature of the questions that are asked, the impression that I'm getting is, you know, people are in general supportive of greater access to alcohol. And I think one of the issues that came up today, and Jack Wagner talked a lot about it, was that, well, what folks don't know are the details of what's actually being considered, that many people think, and incorrectly, that the bills that are under consideration will lead to you being able to go into the grocery store and buy a six-pack of your favorite beer. And that's not on the table here.
Yeah, I never thought that.
Well, one of the arguments that's being made is that the popular support that appears to be in the polls probably is a reflection of the fact that people aren't aware that, you know, what's being proposed isn't actually what they want. That was a big theme today.
Yeah, see, I'm in favor of how they do it in Ohio, where I grew up in Cleveland, where you can drive in through one of the little drive-through beer sales places, and they hand you one can of cold beer, and half the time they'll open it for you. kind of makes drinking and driving a sport, if you will. I'm in favor of that. Let's go do that. If we're gonna live in conservative world, let's do it. Last question I've got for you. Look at this privatization scheme. What you talked about today down in Philadelphia. Again, November of 2010, Republicans ran on jobs, jobs, jobs. Does this create jobs?
No. You know, in fact, it's along the lines of a common theme of this current legislature. You know, because obviously there are those 5,000 workers that are currently in the system. In the state stores that earn good wages, they have benefits, pensions, and health care, and basically, you know, those good jobs are going to be eliminated and replaced more often than not by part-time, low-wage, you know, near minimum wage jobs. So it's fitting into the pattern of this legislature, you know, from their attacks on prevailing wage, their attacks, at least verbally, on public sector workers. You know, it's sort of, it's not directed at actually creating good jobs in the economy. It's actually moving in the direction of, you know, creating more jobs that pay very little.
Well, good. I mean, at least they're living up to their well, no, they're not. Lies. Mark Price, labor economist, Keystone Research Center. Appreciate the time. Always great to talk to you, brother.
Hey, thank you, Rick.
Thanks.
Have a good
night. I'm going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. The Rick Smith Show. Tonight we turn back the clock to what we were talking about this time last year. We'll be back live and in the studio on Monday. Enjoy your Thanksgiving holiday. AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Are you feeling that back-to-school squeeze? Backpacks, clothes, shoes, all the things they have to have because last year's stuff is so last year? If you have a supply shortage, we can help. We know what it's like, and we've got the ultimate hall pass for you. Transfer your high interest and department store balances to PSECU. Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate, good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pscu.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Always nice to talk to Mark Price. And again, you know what I would like to see, and if we're gonna go that route, we're gonna hock off the state wine and spirit shops. We've got to hock off the beer distributors. It's a pain sometimes to go buy a case of beer. In fact, I've got probably 2.5 6-packs sitting in my closet, in our pantry, that we haven't used. We had a party and had a couple people had a beer, had to go buy a whole case. I would like to go and buy maybe just a 6-pack at my local drive-in. Or you know what, better yet, just a can. I'm thirsty. It's been a rough day on the way home. Let me just buy a can. I mean, if we're going to go down this path, let's go all the way.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, Rick. I got to tell you, I've talked to legislators that, the one reason they're on the fence is because they're getting complaints from, you know, people within businessmen that own beer distributorships that are saying, you know, under some of this legislation, we're not going to be treated fairly. So it's going to be interesting to see what comes out. But I was glad to see Jack Wagner, who, by the way, has a lot of credibility. And when he came out and said, hey, it's going to cost the taxpayers a lot of money, it's the wrong thing to do. You got to understand that. This guy's the Auditor General, and it's his responsibility to look after the investments of this state. So he's looking at it not from a Democrat or a Republican, but he's saying, look, this is a bad way to go for the state.
But it does fit with their ideology, that there should be nothing that you and I own, nothing we should own as citizens of the state of Pennsylvania, nothing that we should own as the Commonwealth. It should all be in the hands of private for-profit interests. And I've been waiting, and I haven't heard, and I think maybe I'm wrong. If there's some folks out there who their churches have come out against this, the Catholic Church has come out against the privatization. I haven't seen it. So 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. If your church has, but I just haven't, and I really thought that you would see the loud voices of the religious community who don't want the negative effects. And there are an awful lot of things that happen when you have increased alcohol consumption and the ease of it. Domestic violence. Beyond the vehicular accidents, beyond drunk driving, beyond that stuff. It's the family stuff. The public stuff. So much.
There are some conservative Republicans, Rick, who are on the fence on this. They're getting a lot of pressure from, their constituents, and I'm assuming it's some of it is from the religious community. There's one big party in this whole thing that was present in the 90s, the Mad Mothers. They're nowhere to be seen. They were a very, very powerful influence in the 90s when they tried to get privatization passed, and it was defeated soundly.
Yeah, where is Matt?
I haven't heard him. I haven't seen him. Mothers Against Drunk Driving, they are nowhere to be seen.
I had a friend who was trying to start a dam chapter, Drunks Against Mad Mothers, but that didn't pan out too well for him.
But you know, hey.
You know what? That's a powerful argument, Rick. You know, I'd like to question some of these legislators. Are you going to go to the mother and father of the son or daughter that was run over by a drunken driver who picked up whiskey late at night and got drunk and ran over and killed your son? Are you going to be able to face them and tell them, well, you know, it was the right thing to do to privatize it? And that will happen. Make no mistake. The increased consumption of alcohol to the point of increased drunken driving will happen. It's inevitable.
No, but as I've said from the beginning, I think the churches have been, for the most part, paid off. We're going to give them vouchers. We need that school vouchers to make sure that you keep them quiet. Like we talked about last night, the Catholic Diocese of Allegheny County there in Pittsburgh, sending out an email telling their principals to tell those people whose children get some grant money or get some help with their tuition, that if they don't lobby, if they don't call their representative and document who they called and when they called and what they said and what was said to them, and then return it to them, they weren't going to get any money next year. There used to be a crime. Let me see. Extortion. Yeah, there was one of them. Extortion's a good one. Evidently we're not going to look into that.
So you're telling me that the Catholic Church, a representative of the men of God, are engaging in quid pro quo. Is that what you're telling us?
Yeah, I know. It's unfathomable, isn't it?
I'm shocked.
They wouldn't cover anything up. No.
Do we really want to get into that?
I didn't get into anything. I just said they wouldn't.
I know what you're referring to, but
it's where your mind went.
My mind and millions of other Americans when you think of the Catholic Church and accountability.
But here again, I mean, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, they had a story yesterday on it talking about this. They sent out an email to the principals saying, look, tell all those people who are getting money from us to send their kids to our schools, and if they don't lobby their representative, if they don't call and document when, who they talked to, what they talked about, what was said to them, and return it to us, they're getting nothing next year. They're out on the streets. And I'm telling you, it's my opinion that this is a buy-off. We'll get you vouchers. You shut up about the wine and spirits. Because you would think, the church, churches are supposed to be, in my opinion, our moral conscience. The people who keep us on the straight and narrow, to keep us good, decent people, right? Isn't that what they tell us? Got to be more godly. Got to be more church-like. Kind of like these people who go to this church in Pike County, Kentucky, who have decided that they're not going to allow members who are involved in interracial marriages. Not going to let them happen. The moral conscience of the country. I mean, it's one of those things that just makes you kind of laugh. But here again, the payoff. The payoff are the vouchers. You talk about big money, that's the big money. They're going to privatize not only the wine and spirit shops, but our education as well. And I guess, maybe if I were, the leader of the church, I can go get my wine just about anywhere. No, if there are going to be 10 times as many wine and spirit shops, as Mark said, the Tea Party think tank thinks there should be 10 times as many as there are now. I mean, think about that.
Well,
10 times.
There's one thing that the Catholic Church is going to have to do if that happens. They're going to have to pay more probably for their wine. Jack Wagner has said that. A lot of the brands that are their best sellers, you can bet their prices are going to go up substantially.
Yeah, but here's the thing. And maybe there's some calculus going in. There's a lot to flesh out in this. From the church's perspective, if people are drinking more, they're probably sinning more. Which means they come to confession more. Which means that you can say you need to put some more money into the pot. You want to be forgiven? Money in the pot. I remember when I was a kid, everything was money in the pot. And on Monday, if there was no money in the pot, they were calling the house saying, hey, where's the money? My mother said no money.
If that's true, if the number of sins gets them more income, boy, they must have made money off of you, huh?
Yeah, but here's the thing. I was broke. I mean, the sad reality is the people who, who tend to do the little sinning, they're the people who are broke. The Al Capones of the world, the really big sinners, they gave a lot of money.
So I know you used to talk about if your mother didn't have the money, she would do work for him. Did you have to do work for the church?
No, I didn't. My mother did clean the rectory and clean the the nun house and you know, the church, you know, swept the floor and did stuff like that, did odd work when they needed it to help pay the tuition. And, you know, look, I'm not, I hope everyone has the opportunity to do what they do. But at the end of the day, if there is a quid pro quo here, I got a problem with that. And, you know, look, the reality is public education is public education. If I want to send my children to private school, that should be on me. That's not a matter of the public realm. Once we start pulling money out of it, man, it's only going downward. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Tonight we turn back the clock to what we were talking about this time last year. We'll be back live and in the studio on Monday. Enjoy your Thanksgiving holiday.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Max Richmond of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare says both programs are highly popular and very successful, and there's no economic reason to cut them. Richmond was part of a group of labor leaders and progressives who met with President Obama recently to talk about the so-called fiscal cliff looming in January. Richmond came away from that meeting believing that President Obama will protect Social Security and Medicare.
The president, after I spoke about Social Security and Medicare, he claimed that the people were with him, and he believes, I think, he has a mandate to protect beneficiaries in any way he can. And I'm hoping and I believe that he will follow through on those campaign commitments.
Richmond says a post-election poll by Lake Research Partners shows voters strongly opposed to cuts in Social Security and Medicare. That includes opposition to raising the retirement age. Majorities also support raising the income cap on the Social Security tax as a means of strengthening Social Security. Richmond says Social Security is a strong, successful program as reflected by the annual trustees report.
They announced that this program would be able to pay everybody every penny they're entitled to until the year 2034.
Walmart workers at stores around the country are poised to walk off their jobs on Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving. Workers are pushing for changes in working conditions and a real voice on the job at the nation's largest retailer. Walmart has filed an unfair labor practice charge against the UFCW union, accusing the union of violating labor law in its Walmart campaign. Hobby Lobby plans to appeal a ruling saying the company isn't exempt from the Obama administration's contraception mandate. Jesse Russell reports.
Hobby Lobby has been denied an exemption to providing employees with emergency contraception through their group health plan. The company is run by the family of David Green, who argued in the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Oklahoma that the rule violated their Christian beliefs. Judge Joe Heaton said the rule did no such thing, as Hobby Lobby is a secular, for-profit enterprise and does not possess the same religious rights as an individual. The Green family considers emergency contraception, such as the day-after pill, as an abortion drug. Hobby Lobby must comply with the new rule by January 1, 2013. If it doesn't, it could face a fine of nearly $1.3 million per day. Hobby Lobby had been providing emergency contraception until the mandate garnered significant media attention. The company said it didn't realize it was included in the health plan, so it stopped offering the contraception. Hobby Lobby is one of more than 40 companies challenging the mandate.
This newscast made possible in part through underwriting support from the IBEW. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I gotta listen to man.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You know, next week, December 5th, the entire week there are activities going on in Washington, D.C. With this whole Take Back the Capitol movement that's going on. And look, when you tie this together, all of these activities that are going on around the country with the occupation movements in all the different cities, I'm encouraged by the fact that you're seeing people who have said, I've had enough already. It's time that we go to the Capitol. It's time we get out into the streets and we say, you know what? Our economy has worked for the top 1% really, really well. We would like it to work for us as well, which is why I think it's great that we're seeing folks get out in the street. And that's why I've asked Jerome Wilson, who is currently an underemployed environmental service worker from the Pittsburgh area, to come talk to us about why he's going to be heading to D.C. on December 5th. Jerome, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, Rick, how are you?
I appreciate the time, brother.
I appreciate your opportunity to let me on.
I appreciate you coming on. What's taking you to D.C. on the 5th?
Well, we got to look at how the top 1% has been bailed out, and the 99% of us are still struggling with debt and financial difficulties. We're hardworking people in this country, and we deserve a better shake than just our corporations getting an even shake.
Yeah, you know, you see what's coming out of Washington and coming out of state houses across the country. And if you remember November of 2010, all I kept hearing is, we're going to like laser focus, jobs, jobs, jobs. They came out with a neat little pledge and, you know, flowery language and a lot of pictures about how it was all going to be about jobs, jobs, jobs. Yet all I'm seeing is divisive nonsense, and ridiculous bills that are never going to pass instead of doing what they said they were going to do. Getting folks like you, getting folks like the 14 million people who are unemployed back on the job and earning a wage.
And that's what it's supposed to be about with this jobs bill. But instead of getting jobs, which should be career-minded jobs for people, instead we're seeing them put more politicians in the different areas instead of making it for the people again.
Yeah, you look at the economy, and it's just for people like you and me, people who work for a living, it's dismal.
Yes, it is. It's scary to us, right? Because we have other young people that are going to have to worry about it even worse than we are now, and it shouldn't be about that 1%. It should be about the 99%.
So if you had the chance, you know, this jobs bill, this jobs idea, what direction would you take us? What's the call here?
The call would be to open up more of our infrastructure to bring these jobs back into existence. Remember at one time, even when I grew up in Pittsburgh on the south side, I remembered how they used to dig up the streets to put the new pipes in. So now we still have water pipes bursting, and why are we not a workforce in America again?
That's one part of it for me. The other part of it is trade policy. We for so long have insisted that we're going to be this purveyor of free trade. Yet we're the only one who seem to practice it. But we're going to be the free traders. And basically, what we've ended up doing is trading good paying union jobs for cheap plastic crap from China.
Yes, indeed. And that plastic crap breaks just like our economy is broke. But our economy is not broke because there is money out there, seeing that 1% has it and doesn't want to share it. So where's the wealth being shared when you have a person that's working for 8 hours and they're barely making enough to pay half of their bills?
You know, for me, it all comes back down to, you know, when the president took office back in 2009, I wanted him to pass the Employee Free Choice Act. I wanted him to be able to give workers the opportunity to unionize and organize on the job. And for me, that's a big part of it. The jobs that we do have should be paying a reasonable living wage with health care and with pension benefits, and also trade policies that mandate employers, if you want to sell products in our country, you make them here.
Just like, look at the telemarketing industry. That's basically gone overseas. Those were great paying jobs. I know I worked as one. And I mean, I'm sorry to say, why are we not getting these jobs around to the people as they need them? Because we're going to end up being a broke country. We have broke people now. And like we stated, we have unemployment so high, and it's scary. We have to admit how scary this is.
Yep. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Jerome Wilson. He's a resident, Pittsburgh resident, and also someone who's going to be taking to the streets of Washington, D.C. on December 5th, along with about 100 folks from the Pittsburgh area, going to the Take Back the Capitol events. Again, the whole week there are going to be special things going on there. You can go to the website, 99indc.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Jerome Wilson's name. You know, Jerome, what are you hoping to get out of going, with your fellow citizens from Pittsburgh to D.C. as all these folks from around the country converge on the Capitol? What are you hoping to get out of it?
Well, we're hoping to see that change that we brought our president in with. the idea of a change. The change would be more jobs in America that have been taken out of America, coming back, building our economy back by hiring people so we can start spending money and be happy in this life. I mean, what was the American dream in the 70s? Well, hey, it was to have a radio station or at least be on the air, have something that we can do to help one another. And nowadays, is there an American dream left?
Yeah, well, what we've seen is we've seen this mass consolidation, not only of media, but just about everything else, and this consolidation of wealth into the hands of a very few, which is why I think this 99% movement has gotten the right idea. It's something that we've been talking about here on the program for years, and the labor movement's been talking about for 30 years. As it's, and what I love, and maybe you'll remember this, but you know, when the Tea Party first started, they were talking about, you want to redistribute wealth. And I said, well, what part of the redistribution were you against? The part that took it out of our pockets or the part where we want it back?
Well, we need it back, right? We can't even afford to live comfortably, let alone moderately. We've lost the middle class is about to disappear, and what's going to be next? I mean, how much do we have to pay for items when everything we earn is taxed and everything we spend is taxed? Where's that money going? That we're being hit so hard in that pocket. We're closing schools, and why, when we're still paying taxes that are going up every year?
Yeah, and I come from an area much like Pittsburgh. I grew up in Cleveland, where I look at the buildings that used to employ people, the empty factories, the falling down factories, and I say, you know, how did we let this happen? And how we let it happen is we signed on to these insane free trade agreements that encouraged companies to leave and shed workers from behind. Because look, and I don't, maybe you'll disagree, but I don't think we can compete with the Chinese based on wages. I just don't think it's possible.
Well, we could. We can still compete with anybody in this world, any nation, any country. We just have to remember we are the people of this country, for, of, and by the people.
You know,
as long as we bind and get our strengths back together, we can once again rebuild our economy and have wealth for everyone, not just that 1%, Rick.
So you're not anti 1%, you're just pro 99%.
Yes.
Because
I have to be. I'm part of that 99%.
Because what I keep hearing from the right wing, and you know, maybe you'll disagree, but what I keep hearing from the radicals on the right is that people like you, people like me, folks who are at the occupations are jealous. We're just envious of the 1%, and we want to take everything away from them so everyone's completely equal. And I don't see that to be the case, but I'm curious what your thoughts are.
Well, we're not into taking everything away from them. We just want them to share. And once again, there's so much being done that isn't being done right that maybe they need to lose their wealth. Bring these CEOs back down to making $8 an hour and see how they like it, instead of them being able to invest their money in Swiss bank accounts and in foreign countries being built up. We need to invest in America. That's what America stood for at one time. And why have we lost that in the thousands?
Are you discouraged by the discourse in D.C. and really across the country?
Yes, because for one, if you can bail out big corporations, what happened to the people being bailed out? There's so much debt amongst people that are hardworking that even in the workplace, people don't get along too good because they're upset at what's going on in D.C.
Excellent point. The 14 million people who are unemployed, just a thought. Are they lazy, as we've been told? Are they shiftless?
Not in America. We're not lazy people in America. We get up every day to look for jobs. I know many people that are unemployed, and they're out there every day trying to find employment. The employment's not there because we have the 1% holding back their money that could cause more jobs to be opened for everyone in this country.
Excellent, excellent point. Jerome Wilson, let me ask you last question I've got for you, December 5th. Again, the Take Back the Capitol events going on. You're going to be down there on Monday. Are you going to stay a day or so? Because I know I'm looking at their website, and there's 5 days of actions going to be happening where people are going to set up a camp, and they're going to start talking about kind of doing an occupation for a week.
Yes, I'll be there, Rick.
For the whole week or just for the first
week?
I would love to talk to you again as
like to see you again also, because I did catch you up in Hershey.
Outstanding.
Yes. We had a conversation in Hershey.
Once. Outstanding. Well, yeah. I would love to have you back on the program. Tell me what's going on the ground there in D.C. next week.
Will do, Rick.
Jerome Wilson, thanks so much. I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Rick. I appreciate the offer.
You know, you look at this, and again, there are every day there's going to be an action going on as people converge from across the country to, you know, get the message out. Look, people don't just wake up one day and go, you know what, I'm going to go sleep in the Capitol for a week because they just feel like it. They do it because they're ticked off, they're angry, and they want their voice heard. And that's why I'm encouraged by this, and I hope we do hear from Jerome next week. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around.
In an ocean of red.
You are listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Tonight we turn back the clock to what we were talking about this time last year. We'll be back live and in the studio on Monday. Enjoy your Thanksgiving holiday. AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
The sky is falling. The end times are upon us. It's all over for America, and it's all because of you. You, the execrable voters. This is the wretched wail of a few corporate chieftains who claim to be somewhere between flummoxed and furious that Barack Obama is back in the White House. With his diabolical Obamacare and tax-the-rich attacks on us wealthy job creators, they moan, this president is out to destroy American business. There's a tsunami coming, cried one, so we must save ourselves. How do these trembling titans of free enterprise intend to do that? By firing employees, thus sending a message to workers that voting for Democrats is bad for their health. Elections have consequences, exclaimed a Las Vegas boss after offing 22 workers the day after Obama was reelected. Echoing this self-serving political ethic, a Georgia executive told C-SPAN that his fear of Obamacare made him fire enough workers to exempt his business from providing health care. I tried to make sure that the people I had to lay off voted for Obama, he noted, spewing spite. Then there's Papa John's, the billion-dollar-a-year fast food chain. John Schnatter, the present papa of Papa John's, had warned this summer that he'd jack up the consumer price of the chain's pizza if Obama won, because he was not going to eat the cost of assuring health coverage for employees. Post-election, however, Schnatter has decided not to slap his customers, but to slap Papa John's workers instead by cutting their hours to part-time so he doesn't have to pay for their coverage. That's what you do, Schnatter snapped. You pass on costs. This is Jim Hightower saying, that's what you do, and what an exemplary way for the millionaire boss to boost productivity, loyalty, and morale of those who do the actual work that make customers want to buy Papa John's pizza, or not.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Your proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Come all you good workers, good news to you out there. Around the good old union has come in here to clear.
Well, I got
an email during the break. Of course, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally, and some of them on the air. Andy writes, please, Mr. Obama doesn't care about us. What are you smoking? Card check ain't going to happen with this dude. You got to get someone else in there for card check. He's neoliberal. This is Chicago school time with the hiss student of Milton Friedman. Yes, let's compete with North Koreans. Kaesong Industrial Commerce, free trade zone where workers have no benefits, get 25 cents per hour through the South Korean free trade agreement using the NAFTA template. And, you know, I got to be honest, can't argue. I just can't on that. Let's go to the phone lines. I got Stosh on line one. How are you doing tonight, Stosh?
All right, Rick. How you doing today?
I'm ticked off. I'm frustrated. I'm angry. And I'm hoping that people saw what happened in Congress today and saw the Republicans for who they really are.
I understand your frustration. I feel the same way. And like the guy you had earlier this week from New York.
Yeah, Vinny.
His frustrations that the guy just came on before I did. That's, to me, they're missing the point. The 1% who are in control of our Republican corporate congressmen, they are anti-Obama. And the people don't realize, they think that, I don't know what they think anymore, but they're missing the point. It's all about getting President Obama out of the office. They're trying to crush the Republicans that helped vote Obama in, because all the blacks and browns could not have gotten Obama in without the support of the white people.
Right.
And they're trying to crush every last Republican that is not a white corporate Republican. And they can't see it. They're not talking about it. They don't see it. But it's plain that the 1% who control the Republican corporate Congress, they're doing everything in their power to make Obama look like he's the reason why the situation is the way it is. That's not it.
Yeah, well, you know, he's not, I got to be honest, the president's not helping himself on a lot of frames as well, but I get your point. So the question I guess I have for you is Herman Cain right? Are stupid people ruining America?
That goes back to how to destroy our education. Look at the stupid people that a lack of education is enabling to make stupid things, stupid judgments. Everything points back to they're trying to hurt, like you say, crush, burn, and slash, and kill. That's what they're trying to do to the people who voted for Obama.
Yep.
And they're doing everything in their power to not let him get a foothold as far as jobs, or the jobs. They ain't the only job they're concerned about is eliminating Obama's job. And that's it. But nobody was talking about the real issue. That's the real issue as far as I'm concerned. Everybody talks about this, that, and the hope and optimism. There ain't no optimism. They're trying to crush Obama at any means, all means possible. And they don't want to face up to the fact that if they don't vote the right way in 2012, they can kiss this country goodbye.
Yeah, that's what I'm worried about. But, you know, again, you know, they're quite honest about it. They wanted Obama to fail right from the beginning.
I hope he fails.
You know, Mitch McConnell said he's going to make him a one-term president. You know, the Republicans, right from the very beginning, they had it in for him, and you're right. You're right on that vein.
That's the issue as far as I'm concerned. They don't care about nothing about making him fail, and they're going to crush everybody that voted for him to do so and try pinning on him, but not realizing if they do bring him down, the country goes down with it, it's going to be another war. I mean, a war with people getting hurt, killed, shot, and that opened up the opportunities for all those countries who don't like us to come in and start more problems.
I hope that doesn't happen, but I don't see any other country coming, and I see our investor class using our military to make sure that they're always in control, because they're never going to cede power unless we wrestle it from them. I appreciate the call, Stosh. Thanks so much.
All right.
You're spot on. Call back anytime. You know, I look at it and, you know, maybe Kane's right. Maybe the country is run by stupid people. Maybe we're ruining this nation with too many stupid people. When it comes down to, you know, what do the investor people want? What do the wealth class want? I think Carlin hit it right.
They don't want a population of citizens capable of critical thinking. They don't want well-informed, well-educated people capable of critical thinking. They're not interested in that. That doesn't help them. That's against their interest. That's right. You know something? They don't want people who are smart enough to sit around the kitchen table to figure out how badly they're getting by a system that threw them overboard 30 years ago. They don't want that. You know what they want? They want obedient workers. Obedient workers. People who are just smart enough to run the machines and do the paperwork and just dumb enough to passively accept all these increasingly easier jobs with the lower pay, the longer hours, the reduced benefits, the end of overtime, and the vanishing pension that disappears the minute you go to collect it. And now they're coming for your Social Security money. They want your retirement money. They want it back so they can give it to their criminal friends on Wall Street. And you know something? They'll get it. They'll get it all from you sooner or later because they own this place. It's a big club, and you ain't in it. You and I are not in the big club.
Light bulb.
You know, look, and imagine that. That's 15 years ago he said that.
I was going to say, I know you love him. I mean, I saw him. I mean, he's a great comedian. You know, God rest his soul, but I don't believe even George realized how much of a visionary he was.
Oh, no, I think he knew. I think he knew. But he was more than a comedian. He was a social commentator.
He was a social commentary who cared about his country in his own way.
But, you know, you look at this, and what's amazing to me is how accurate he was.
He was spot on.
They don't want people who are capable of critical thought. They don't want to look at Snow White. They don't want people who look at Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs and go, are you freaking kidding me? That's the best this nation's got to offer? A guy who was basically hawking a book, was a pizza salesman who was hawking a book, a guy who he doesn't know what he thinks one day to the next, a serial adulterer. Go down the list, the crazy woman. That's the best our nation has to offer? Wow. Again.
And you know what's ironic? Now, here you have Newt Gingrich, who's actually prospering in this race, because Kane has, it looks like he was an adulterer, and yet you talk about a serial adulterer, Newt Gingrich. Isn't that ironic? He's prospering. He actually probably did more running around with women and immoral things than Kane did.
Yeah, well,
he's going to prosper.
You talk about Kane, and I find it interesting. He came out and he said, well, you know, stupid people are ruining the country. Have you looked at his campaign? I mean, you know, Politico did a really good article on a study of ineptitude. If you look at they're going to be studying his campaign for years, they claim, because everything that you could possibly do to screw things up, he has done. And yet still, he's doing okay. And for me, if you go back to what I said from the beginning, the guy was just on a book tour. He was looking for the next job. He's like Santorum. Santorum was just looking for another job. He knew he didn't stand a snowball's chance of winning. It's about getting your word out there, getting your message out there, and a think tank paying you a boatload of money, or maybe somebody putting you in a cabinet position. Kane wants to be a star. He wants to be that figurehead. He wants to be the guy on TV or on the radio selling books. That's what he wants. He doesn't want to be president. And part of me goes, he got into it thinking, well, I'll be able to hawk some books and, you know, it'll be a nice, you know, dog and pony show, and then I'll get my gig on Fox. Never thinking that I'm going to skyrocket to the top of the polls and everybody, the spotlight will be on me, and then every indiscretion I have ever done in my life is going to come out, and then I'm going to have to fess up. Now, had he done what I've said I would do if it ever happened to me, and if I ever ran for office, if I ever got knocked on the head and I decided to run for office, what I would do if someone said, hey, did you do this? And I would go, yeah, that was a while ago. Screwed that up. Learned that lesson. Because he said he runs a different kind of campaign. Had he come out when those women first came out and accused him of harassment, had he come out and said, hey, you know what? Look, good-looking woman. We went to dinner together. We had a couple of drinks. We were flirting back and forth. I took it as she was interested. We went somewhere. Turns out she wasn't. I made a pass. She said no. It ended there. That's what it was. I would have been okay with that. I said, okay, yeah, you're honest about it. You screwed up. Yeah. I've had that happen to myself. But the other go, I never did such a thing. Come on.
Well, this last little woman said, you know, she came out. Now, this is what she said. To some degree, it does make sense. She said, look, I mean, he's attacking these other women, and I know what the kind of relationship he had with me. So I felt sorry for him attacking these other women, and I came out. And actually, I think he was pretty much dead in the water before this, Rick. I mean, some of the stupid things he said in the last couple of weeks, he showed total ineptness on some. But very, very important issue.
But hold on. You think he was going down. I think he was going up. Because you got to remember who he's pandering to, who the base is, the idiot doofus base, the people who don't care about any of that stuff. They love the 999 plan because it's simple and stupid. And he's right. Stupid people are running the country. Anybody who would have voted for him. Oh, that's right. I was going to vote for him.
Well, he can pass those other ones off as, well, you know, it might not. I have to wait and see. But this was, according to her, 13 years, and she has some documentation. That's a little bit different.
Well, you know, and again, it's none of my business. Had he come out and say, yeah, you know, I screwed up, you know, is what it is.
It's going to be interesting to see if Newt gets the nomination, how they're going to justify after they went after Bill Clinton viciously.
He's not.
Because he had sex in the White House.
He's not. They're building him up so that they can tear him back down with that stuff.
I think the conservatives are going to embrace Newt Gingrich.
No. I don't think so. Hopefully we'll find out. I mean, that's why we play the game. But I'm not seeing it.
Well,
again, I'm still voting for Herman Cain. I'm going to write him in if I have to.
the neuter, you know, Romney just defies the truth. Now he's totally saying, well, you know, I disagree with Obamacare. Well, and then he tries to make the argument, the facetious argument, that his health care program was totally different. Well, was it? The big concept was pretty much the same. You try to cover as many people as you can, and you have oversight by the state government, and you have oversight. Now, are there particulars that are different? Yeah, but when you get down to the basics, they weren't that different.
There you go. Anyway, stupid people are ruining the country. Let's take a break right back after this. Stick around.
Before Thanksgiving, also the night before the memorial for Native American genocide, takes a little bit of the starch out of the feast. And I don't mean the dietary starch. Welcome to the Horn, headonradionetwork.com. Your home for this little experiment we call conversation radio. Easily accessible, places like headonradionetwork.com. Listen live player, or on TuneIn Radio, Stitcher Radio, Tuner Internet Radio app, Dar.fm, Streama.com, Roku, and a variety of other platforms that make internet radio the future of broadcasting. Seeing as how the public commons has been sold off, or at least the airwaves of the public commons have been sold off to right-wing dominated corporations. Yeah, I know. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. This little effort is listener-driven and listener-supported. Thank you very, very kindly for the contribution that came in this evening that finished off last night's challenge by our buddy John and got us a third of the way toward this evening. So we only need to raise $100 this evening, which would be awfully nice in an effort to keep even with where we have to be. Still, it's still a game-time decision as to whether or not there will be a show on Friday. So I'll tweet it or Facebook it, depending on how it shakes out. Okay? No, we are not going to sing We Gather Together to Eat the Dry Turkey. No. Just, you know, no. But there are traditions associated with this holiday. Oh, yes, there are. There are traditions.
And I think I hear something now. The crowd is moving out into the parking area. And, oh, yes, I can see it now. It's a helicopter. And it's coming this way. It's flying something behind it. I can't quite make it out. It's a large banner. And it says, Happy...
Idea I ever heard of.
Never been anything else like it.
No, I don't suppose there has.
I thought it would work. I planned this thing right down to the last detail. It was perfect.
Where'd you get those birds?
Les, are you okay?
I don't know. A man and his two children tried to kill me. After the turkeys hit the pavement, the crowd kind of scattered, but some of them tried to attack me. I had to jam myself into a phone booth. Then Mr. Carlson had the helicopter land in the middle of the parking lot. I guess he thought he could save the day by turning the rest of the turkeys loose. It's pretty strange after that.
Yes, you're right. Now, Les, come on now, tell us the rest.
I really don't know how to describe it. It was like the turkeys mounted a counterattack. It was almost as if they were organized.
As God is my witness, I thought turkeys could fly.
How can you not love it? The classic WKRP from 1978, I believe. The Thanksgiving turkey drop. Especially relevant to anybody who's ever worked in small or, you know, local market radio. Been subjected to the wild and wacky and often harebrained schemes of the promotions department and the Herb Tarlicks of the world. That's utterly believable. He started hitting the ground like sacks of wet cement. God, I love it. Happy Thanksgiving. And take a moment tomorrow as you're giving thanks to whomever or whatever. I try to give my thanks to our family, you know, just for being there. And to you, to us, who have created this little online community. They talk about the impersonal nature of the internet, but we really have created a family here. That's why we call it the Horn family. If I catch myself using the word audience, I kind of stomp my own toe with, because that's not what this is. So there will be a big glass lifted to members of the Horn family now, in the future, and those who have gone on. Looks like the weather's going to be pretty good tomorrow. We're trying an experiment. Thanksgiving is no time to experiment with turkeys, as the previous clip shows. But nonetheless, we are. I love beer can chicken. You've done beer can chicken, right? Well, we're escalating things a bit. Got a bag of charcoal, bag of hickory, and a small bag of applewood chips. The hickory and the applewood chips are cooking now. When the show's over, the thawed turkey will get the beer can chicken treatment, but since turkeys are bigger, we had to opt for a Foster's lager can. And we will stand said bird upright in the smoker. And just see what 12 hours or so of sweet wood smoke will do to said fowl. I'm guessing the results will be pretty tasty as long as we don't let him dry out. And when the feast begins tomorrow, you know, like I said, very traditional. Homemade dressing, mashed potatoes and gravy, canned cranberry sauce. It's kitschy, but it's good. Lottie's sweet potato pie for dessert and a pumpkin pie as well. When we sit down to that dinner, a toast will be hoisted. And it will be to us and to you, for whom we give great thanks, who have proven this little experiment to be successful over the years. And not just successful, but joyful. Sure, we complain and carry on and talk about right-wing morons and the like, but we do it with good humor and good heart, and we do it knowing that as long as we're doing it together, we're beating back the isolation, and it gives us a little better chance of keeping the barbarians away from the gates. Yeah, Jack in Shreveport loved the WKRP turkey clip. No, Marty, I'm not. I'm not going to quick... No, I won't do that fry a turkey thing. I mean, I don't mind cooking experiences that involve danger and fire and flare-ups and things like that, but that's just courting disaster. Dr. John, under the subject line, just joined in, right at, see what 12 hours of sweet wood smoke will do to said fowl. I came to the right place, says Dr. John. Yep. I don't know, maybe we'll post some pictures on Facebook or something if it comes out as pretty and lovely as I expect it to. The real hitch is going to be the Foster's can and standing the bird up. I don't know. Should we forego that and just do it sitting down like we always do? I guess we'll find out. Mercifully, there was a sale on turkeys, so it will not be a total disaster. And, you know, if it dries out, there's always turkey salad on Friday. Like I said, Friday is still up in the air as to whether there will be a show Friday evening. The following week, however, does get a little different. And because we will be going on the road to do some pavement pounding, walking the halls of Congress in D.C. over the trying to get more sponsors for the ACE Act, ACHEACT.org, ACEACT.org. Bring some folks on board to make it a stronger bill when it gets reintroduced in the new Congress. This is exciting work. But I'll take the rig with me, and I'll try to set it up so that we can do some broadcasting from there. It'll be Skype calls only, so if you don't have a Skype account, you might want to set one up so you can reach the program. Well, that's just Marty noting, my cousin has it down to a fine art, not even dry. Not going to my cousin's, though. So you're doing your own bird, Marty, I trust. But it's not just the evening before Thanksgiving. As Jim noted with an email a few minutes ago, in loving memory, President John Fitzgerald Kennedy, 1917 to 1963, taken too soon, 22 November 1963, 49 years ago tomorrow. Under circumstances in which probably a majority of this country are still not satisfied that the real story has ever been told, whatever that real story may be. And it's Wednesday, of course. Prayer meeting Wednesday. My Thanksgiving treat to Kate will be to leave the preacher locked up in the basement of the herpetological seminary. But it is Wednesday, and it is prayer meeting Wednesday. And Brian Fisher has become just about as much fun as any human being can have when it comes to enjoying the paranoid, psychotic stylings of the right-wing evangelical religion industry. I reckon he's down there in Tupelo, Mississippistan, at the home base of the American Family Association. And he is still he's still pretty worked up about the whole Benghazi thing. And he thinks he's got it figured out. And he's got it figured out because, of course, stuff in the Old Testament is still relevant today, even though they're wildly different cultures. By the way, I tweeted a couple of things last night. I just happened to walk in, and lo and behold, and Ferg was kind of proud of himself, said, "Look, Dad, I'm not watching cartoons. I'm watching something intelligent." Oh, dear. What it turned out he was watching was this thing on the History Channel called Mankind, the Story of Us. Now, I've had a number of email exchanges with Dr. John and mentioned some of these things as well on the air. I have given up all hope that television, especially for-profit television, will ever do anything approaching a credible job with the history of humanity, science, and like I said, for-profit television. And I guess there's some profiting involved with public broadcasting, PBS, but not as much as on the stations where there's a life insurance commercial or something every 7.5 minutes or so. You know, like the History Channel. And so I sat and I watched a little bit. And I almost got the laptop out to fire off another email note to Dr. John, our archaeology and anthropology consultant. But I figured I wouldn't ruin his evening or morning if he'd already gone to bed. Jesus criminy. If you haven't watched Mankind, the Story of Us, don't. If you have, go get a good book on the topic and just try to get some of it straightened out in your own mind, if no one else's. I've got so much straightening out to do for Ferg now, I may be busy for the next couple of days. I mean, they offered up the story of Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer, without so much as a mention of the fact that there is no actual historical proof of his existence. Not a shred of it. Third-party mentions, tops. A man who would change the world forever. Well, if you were scripting it with any degree of accuracy, you would say, stories about the man which stories would change the world forever. And then they got to Saul of Tarsus, who later became Paul. Oy. And when they'd blown past that, they went over to explain the Roman Empire. Here's the fun part. You know where they started the Roman Empire? The Emperor Claudius. You know, it goes Augustus, Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius, and then Nero. They started with Claudius. How do you talk about the ancient Roman world without even mentioning Julius Caesar, let alone Octavian, who became Caesar Augustus? Lord, it's frustrating. And I know I'm kind of in the middle of a digression, but the digression has a point. When an outfit that calls itself the History Channel can take as many liberties with factual history as these people did, and the narration by Josh Brolin was nothing to write home about either. But when places that call themselves historic or interested or remotely concerned with history do things like this, pass it off as reality, then what hope does an unsuspecting, largely uninformed audience, because we don't do the classics much anymore, have when Brian Fisher of the American Family Association decides to explain current events as a function of events that happened during the reign of King David? There are lots of kings back then. But, you know, this is the guy who had the traditional family values marriage with 900 wives and 700 concubines or some such. But it still wasn't enough. Hence, yes, Benghazi is just like an event in 2 Samuel. I kid you not. Come on, Brian Fisher. Oh, for pity's sakes. Here we go. Maybe. Well, it was working a few minutes ago. One of these days, this tired old computer will get replaced. Or rebuilt or something. Are we having a... No, no problem with the interweb tubes. Oh, heavens to Betsy. Jim, I'm not so sure, because the episode I saw ran, he said prior to Caligula, they ran programs on previous emperors. The previous episode that was rolling when I walked in and Ferg was watching, they were talking about the Iron Age. So, not so sure. But Lord, it was terrible. So is this little internet glitch. What in the world is going on? Okay, so nobody, yeah, no, we're not buffering up here or anything. It's this particular. I don't know. Maybe Brian Fisher has some hackers or something. I was so looking forward to this story because it's not every day you get to work in a reference to Uriah. Because that's what this is all about from 2 Samuel 11, the story of Uriah the Hittite. And everybody who knows their 2 Samuel knows the story of Uriah the Hittite. An upright and righteous man, this Uriah the Hittite. But he was married to apparently a stunningly beautiful woman named Bathsheba. And David, who had 900 and some odd wives and 700 and some odd concubines. I mean, a hell of a lot more than one man and one woman, any way you slice, if I don't have the numbers right. Well, David got the hots for Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah the Hittite. And he, well, they were slamming sandals, as it were. And she got pregnant. David had a war going on at the time, and Uriah the Hittite was a mighty warrior. So lo and behold, David, once Bathsheba has come to him and says, Dave, baby, yeah, have I got a surprise for you? Mm-hmm. And while many, many cultures knew how to do things like terminate pregnancies, I mean, it was lots of ways in the ancient world. Apparently, they hadn't learned that yet. And so David called his counselors together and said, hey,